chairperson has sent me a message, and I apologize for responding. It's very bad. I obviously went to play golf or something. I forgot about it. The four members of the legislature who are spending the morning with us during these hearings is the chairperson, Ms. Sikakana. I hope I pronounced it correctly. Then Mos Maikiso. Most of you should know him. He's written books and things. Trina. And then member Thomas Wall. Welcome to all of you, and we hope you enjoy your day with us. Don't look forward to the food, it's not much. Then also to the mining industry. It's not often that you get the big bosses on the mines here. They apparently have a lot of solutions and so on, so we're very lucky today. We're going to have a nice smooth meeting, quickly leave and sort out everything. And then, of course, the public and the media, welcome. There seems to have been some interest in acid mine drainage. People have been attending, so there must be something of interest on the topic. What we'll do today is we'll first take a overview of the different mines involved and whatever the overview will give us from one of the representatives of one of the mines. So that's a more general outlook. And then we'll take each specific mine, hopefully by looking at how big the problem is in that mine, what they've been doing about it, and what solutions they see are the main issues really we need to address. And then we'll take the Chamber of Mines at the end to really pull together all the things for us and see what proposals they have in this regard. So I hope we have a good engagement. Are there any issues that any of the members want to raise before we start? That's fine. Okay, Mr. Munro, I understand you on first. Go ahead for us.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Munro. I'm the chief executive of
Brand Uranium. It's one of the companies that has been heavily involved in managing the acid mine drainage on the Western Basin. As the chairman said, I'm first going to give you an overview of what the various companies have been doing collectively, as well as a little bit of history on the AMD, because it is important in meeting the chairman's request to tell him what we are doing and how we see this being solved, that you understand a bit about how this problem came to exist. I think that provides very important context. So it says at the bottom, I'm the spokesperson for the active company. It's not quite true. I'm just providing an overview. Each of the individual companies will speak on their own behalf. In this introductory slide, there's reference to three corporations in those three logos there. And they refer to the three collective bodies through which the industry has undertaken its various activities regarding AMD. And I will talk about their relevance a little bit further on, so just bear with me. Chairman, would you like to take questions between slides?
No, you just go on.
I tend to speak very fast because I feel very strongly about this topic, so please stop me if it's getting chaotic.
You just go on. You'll hear me when you hear me.
Okay, good. So starting with a little bit of history on the big picture of acid mine drainage on the Witwatersrand, and now I'm talking the whole Witwatersrand. As I said, it's important for us to focus on what we're doing and what we think can be done to solve this problem. But a little bit of background and the big picture is important. The Western Basin, which is the area roughly underneath Krugersdorp on the western side of Johannesburg, was the first of the basins that presented a problem from an AMD point of view. Going back in history, mining started in the Western Basin in the late 1800s and then continued up until the 1990s. So mining stopped underground in the 1990s. That's an absolute fact. There's no question about whether mining continued underground thereafter. So the mining stopped in the 1990s, and obviously once the mining stopped, the pumping of water from underground stopped, and over a period of time, the underground workings filled up with water, which is largely rainwater, ingressing into the workings through various mechanisms. And I'll show you a diagram a little bit further on that. So over the period, late 1990s to 2002, basically these big holes underground filled up with water, And the water eventually overflowed in the form of acid mine drainage in 2002. At that stage, and I wasn't around then, I was working for a company that had operations in Ghana and Australia, but the history is pretty well documented. Between 2002 and 2005, there was a huge amount of running around to deal with this imminent crisis. And really, it was a period of trying to figure out who was going to do what. There was a lot of legal work, as well as a lot of practical work undertaken. In 2005, the Department of Water Affairs issued some directives to the companies that were present in the Western Basin at the time. At the same time as the directives, a lot of work was done in an attempt to apportion liability for the AMD that had now started to overflow in the Western Basin. And I think, again, it's a statement of fact that any attempt at apportionment failed. From 2005 right through to 2011, all attempts at legal action have turned to be fruitless, largely because of the very complex history and the long history of underground mining in the Western Basin, which, as I said, started in the 1800s and terminated in 1990. But despite all the legal wrangling, as well as the discussion amongst the parties as to what to do, at least two things came out of the discussions around 2005. The first was the installation of temporary treatment measures, and I'll talk more about those going on. Those are partial treatment water plants that deal with the AMD only partially. At the same time, the industry, and I'm talking more as the companies present at that time, committed to finding a long-term solution to the AMD, recognizing that the plants that were established in 2005 were only meant as a temporary measure. They were never seen as permanent solutions. If we now jump then to 2011, 6 years later, unfortunately, despite all this work, the AMD remains a very serious problem, not only in the Western Basin where it's not yet solved, but indeed it's a growing threat in the other two basins, the Central and Western Basin, Eastern Basin. So today, the temporary treatment operations continue in the Western Basin, and the industry, through a lot of collaborative work, has proposed a long-term solution to deal with the AMD across all three basins, and that's what we'll come to later on in the presentation as requested. As you know, the Central Basin is flooding at a rate that suggests that it will overflow in about 2 years from today. The date is not exact, but I think what's important is to accept it will overflow. We have a living, breathing example in the Western Basin. Mining stopped, the water filled up, and it overflowed, and the quality of the water was dreadful. We believe that the same thing will happen in the Central Basin. The only difference is it's a much larger basin, and I'll talk about that on a coming slide. And as you know, in the Eastern Basin, the pumping stations there have been removed, and as a result, that basin is busy flooding. So we have three examples: the Western Basin overflowing, the Central Basin flooding quite fast, and the Eastern Basin starting to flood. So I don't believe that the threat of AMD to the environment, to livelihoods, to the stability of some buildings, and generally to Gauteng should be underestimated. We as an industry believe it is an extremely serious matter, and are delighted with the action that has been taken in the last year or so by the leadership taken by the Interministerial Committee, and indeed these hearings about where the action is today, because it really, from our point of view, is all about action, as opposed to examining what happened over the last 100 years, which we believe will be fruitless. I did say I'd introduce in overview the companies that have been involved in operations in one form or another in the three basins. Starting on the left-hand side, we have the Western Basin. Rand Uranium is a company. We don't actually mine in the Western Basin, but we have a presence there because we own land there, and we operate the water treatment plant in the Western Basin. We have Mintails, which operates the surface mine there, DRD Gold and Westwood, which are present in other forms. In the Central Basin, we have ERPM, an old mine, Central Rand Gold, which is attempting to build a new business, and Westwood. On the Eastern Basin, there's Ergo, which is a surface mining operation, and then there's Aurora, and obviously the status of that is in question, given the liquidation proceedings and various other ongoing legal matters there. But what I'd like to focus you on is the three bodies in green: the Western Basin Environmental Corporation, the Central Basin in the middle, and the Eastern Basin Environmental Corporation. Those were put together by the companies in each of those basins to undertake collective action. It was really a collective action body which allowed us to channel effort into collective work and to deal with stakeholders and regulators on a more coherent basis. With this large number of companies, obviously it's difficult for outsiders to engage the various mining companies. Over time, we have come to recognize that collective action across all three basins makes more sense, And so the industry has in fact combined its efforts into the Orange Block, which is the Witwatersrand Basin's Water Corporation. The name doesn't really matter. It's a point of collective action. The organization at the bottom refers to the Western Utilities Corporation. That is an external third-party funded company that the mining companies brought in to help try and solve this problem. And I'll talk more about the role that WUC has played over time, as well as the role that the industry has played in trying to find a solution, as well as managing the crisis on a short-term basis. Again, just to start with a big picture and give everyone a sense of what we're dealing with, this is a very simple diagram looking, say, from the south towards the north with Johannesburg in front of us. And then if you were to do a slice through the earth, you'd see the Western Basin on the west underneath Krugersdorp. As you move from Krugersdorp through Roodepoort, you get to the Central Basin. And then as you move off to the East Rand, you get to the Eastern Basin. And really, this is a simple diagram to show the underground workings and the old mine shafts, which are the vertical access points for the underground workings. What I'd really like to point out is that this diagram is really what we call a cartoon or a simple picture. What's important to recognize is that on the Western Basin is by far the smallest of the basins or the underground holes in the ground. It will, we believe, on a sustainable basis, produce about 15 megalitres per day of AMD or mine water. And megalitres means millions of litres. The Central Basin is estimated to be four times that size. So on a steady state basis, we believe it will produce about 60 megalitres a day of AMD. And the biggest basin is on the east, which is estimated to produce about 100 megalitres a day once it overflows. So again, it's important to point out that the experience we have on the Western Basin is the tip of the iceberg. It has given us a lot of learnings, and that's very important in looking at a solution and a way for us to manage this on a very constructive basis. Just again, to give you a very brief picture of what acid mine drainage involves. This is a very crude picture. On the two sides, you can see the underground workings. They generally aren't big holes like that. They're more flat-lying and then vertical slices through the earth. The central shape is the mine shaft, and then you can see the sharp head here on top. That's actually typically not true because generally where the AMD overflows is old and disused shafts, as I'll show you in a coming picture. But really what's important to point out is while the mining operations are underway, the water has to be pumped out to keep the workings free, clear of water to allow mining operations to carry on. So if we use the Western Basin as an example, up until late 1990, this would have been the picture on the Western Basin, where the underground water had been pumped to surface and was pumped to surface on an ongoing basis. But then the late 1990s, mining stopped. And once that happened, slowly the underground workings fill up with water. And that's water that ingresses from surface, largely due to rain, but also from fissure water, which is underground water. So the water eventually fills up the workings, and then eventually, following the path of least resistance, will overflow through the old shaft. And this is exactly what it looks like today on the Western Basin. This is one of the very old shafts. You can see that all that it is a piece of old concrete. You can see it hasn't been used for decades. And the water that you see there overflowing is what we call acid mine drainage. This water has a pH of about 3 or 4, which if you put your finger in it would really hurt you. It has a very strong smell of sulfur because the strong element or complex inside it is sulfuric acid. The sulfuric acid then leaches metals out of the host rock, and as a result, the main problem with AMD is it contains low pH, which is basically burns the environment. We have high sulfate, as well as a whole complex of metals. This is very, very unpleasant water, and as a result, our concern in dealing with it, both on an interim and long-term basis, as fast as possible. This overflow today occurs, in fact, yesterday's reading was about 15 megalitres per day of overflow. So this water is really water that has come into the ground from rainfall, flows through the ground, and then comes up through this old mine shaft and overflows on an uncontrolled basis. There is simply nothing you can do to stop this. No amount of civil works will stop this, apart from treating it from underground. So this water overflows at a rate of about 15 megalitres per day. Now, what's important to point out is that over and above the roughly 12 megalitres per day that our company pumps from underground, treats to remove the metals, treats to reduce the pH, and then discharges. So as we stand today, this basin is producing about 30 megalitres a day of acid mine drainage. Now remember, that's at the end of summer. In fact, we're into winter now. But because of the very high levels of rainfall in summer, we believe that this uncontrolled overflow, as we call it, will continue right through winter. In the past, this hasn't happened because the rainfall has been less. But because of the very high rainfall, the treatment operations that we run are unable to cope with the volume coming out of the ground. And as a result, our temporary treatment activities are unable to cope. We are doing the best that we possibly can with the infrastructure that we have, and it's simply not enough. We have this uncontrolled decant of acid mine drainage occurring. But what I'll point out is that in the height of summer, the discharge from this basin can get up to 50 megaliters a day. So some three times the size of this water overflows and flows down the Tweelope Spreit on an uncontrolled basis. Not only is this a poison to the environment, but the volumes of water flowing down that river can do damage to infrastructure and indeed to farmland. So it's not just the quality of the water that's a problem. It's because of this variability in the volumes that we end up with damage being done downstream. So that's a very simple picture of acid mine drainage and a living, breathing example of what happened on the Western Basin, and if we don't move a lot faster, is going to happen on the Central Basin. And hence our appeal for speeding up the action that is underway at the moment. So moving then to the request from the Chairman, which was to outline our activities, both in the past and more particularly, more recently, and in the light of the IMC report, I'd like to just provide an overview and the basis on which the industry was undertaking its activities. And the first is that, and there's been a lot of debate about this, and I think there is a growing consensus, that the AMD is essentially ownerless, and importantly, is a legacy liability from activities that terminated in the previous century. And the second point under which we operate is that the industry, or rather the companies that were there at the time and the companies that are there today, believe that notwithstanding this, we have to do something. People often say to me as the CEO of Rand Uranium, how come you do what you do if it's not your problem? And I'll talk more about that very important question further on because it does frame our approach to this as they're South Africans rather than people living in their own backyard and not concerned about the broader environment. So over time, the industry has undertaken a lot of activity, but it has been without prejudice to our rights and our right to defend ourselves should it ever come to legal activity. We believe that's a fruitless waste of taxpayers' money and indeed our resources, and I'll talk more about that further on. So in light of the uncertain legal position, the industry, working with regulators and with outside parties, has undertaken a number of practical steps since 2005. The first has been the pragmatic approach, which is someone needs to do something, particularly as the Western Basin started overflowing in the early part of this previous decade. And the first has been to operate AMD partial treatment plants. These were always meant as a temporary measure. They were never meant to be a long-term solution. They were meant to be put in place to buy everyone time to develop a long-term sustainable solution. But those plants are in fact still operating today and already reaching the end of their useful life, and that is becoming a problem for everyone. More importantly, once we had a temporary solution in place, there was a lot of work done on the development of a long-term sustainable solution, and we'll talk a lot about that further on. This solution has been presented inside of this country to regulators, to stakeholders, and indeed to the team of experts that was advising the Interministerial Committee from late last year through to early this year. From a practical point of view, the industry working as the individual companies and through the various collective bodies has worked extensively with regulators, with stakeholders and interested parties to try and not only understand the problem, report on the problem, and indeed find a solution to the problem. And I'll show you a bit of the history of the degree of engagement that the companies have undertaken with all stakeholders. One of the things that gave me some comfort in dealing with this as the CEO of the company is that this problem is well understood in the public domain. It's not like it's a big secret in the cupboard. Everyone understands the history of this. Everyone understands why it's occurring. Now we've got to find a solution to it, and I think we have to redouble our efforts to do that faster than we currently are. As I indicated, though, the companies have had to protect themselves legally. We have an obligation to our company and ultimately to our shareholders and creditors not to spend their money unwisely. And as a result, each company has its own unique factual position. What it did and didn't do over the last 5 years, over the last 100 years, if they existed. So it is important to look at the overall industry activity, and I mean more the activities of different companies, but also recognize each of them has their own position, and you will hear from each of the companies during this morning. As I emphasized, there's been a lot of legal action. We have spent hundreds of thousands of rands, if not multiple of millions, in legal actions that have been directed at our company. All of it has come to naught. And again, as an example, I'll talk about Rand Uranium's experience when I talk about our company. So that's really the two legs that we'll approach this morning's discussions on, is focusing on the pragmatic things that we've done as companies and as the industry, but it'll also give you an overview of our legal position as each of the companies see it. And that really takes into account the history of each of the companies and what we've done over previous years. So to talk a bit more about the history in some more detail, this is a long list of items, and I won't go through it in any detail. However, I'd like to break it up into four main periods as we see the evolution of the AMD problem. And again, when I talk about the AMD problem, it's not just the Western Basin. That's the most pressing problem, but it's the Western Basin, then the East Central, and indeed the Eastern Basin as well. Because we do believe as an industry, and indeed as part of a collective, that this needs to be tackled holistically, and that piecemeal solutions will be a substantial waste of money, regardless of whose money it will be at the end of the day. I should have actually started in the 1970s, but I can see, as the chairman said, the committee wouldn't like to hear going back that far. So I'll start when the AMD actually decanted on the Western Basin, and that was in 2002. So from 2002 to 2005 was that period I spoke about of crisis management, attempting to put in place some temporary solutions, as well as attempting to find the culprit. And guess what? They never found the culprit, but at least some temporary plans were put in place. Then we moved to the period 2005, 6, and 7, and that's when we started to see the more collective action. More water treatment plants were put in place, and indeed the collective bodies of WEPEC and CBEC were created. Then we moved to the third period, and probably the most important in our minds, and that was from 2007 to 2009. At that stage, the collective, which represented the industry and the various companies, established an outside body called the Western Utilities Corporation to develop a long-term solution. And that is what we now refer to as the WUC solution, and has been referred to that by the media and other commentators. From 2007 to 2009, this company went about raising money to undertake this work and went through a full feasibility study process to find a long-term, commercially viable, and environmentally sustainable solution to the AMD, not only in the Western Basin, but indeed through the Central and Eastern Basins. A huge amount of work was done. In fact, some 75 million rands worth of work was undertaken. And that is a huge study. Not only did they study the AMD, they studied the underground workings in all the basins. They studied what the water would look like when it decanted its surface. Then they looked at a range of solutions to this, which is a key component of feasibility studies. So they looked at a wide range of alternatives, selected a shortlist, prove those up some more, and then took a final solution to final feasibility study, where it is proven to a very high level of engineering that this solution would work technically, environmentally, and indeed commercially. And that is the solution that was eventually tabled. What's very important to point out is that apart from doing all the technical and financial work, the industry and WUC undertook a huge amount of engagement with civil society, with regulators, with various arms of government, and indeed with local communities. So it wasn't as though this work was done in isolation. Everyone who could possibly have been involved in this was involved in it. And indeed, in 2009, this project received a lot of support. It was mentioned in the department's growth and development documents as by far the most attractive solution to the resolution of the widespread AMD problem. And in fact, in 2009, Water Affairs suggested that it take a leading role in helping WUC deal with the other government departments. The government task team, which was formed to bring the various government departments together to look at the AMD, provided in-principle support to the WUC solution. And in fact, in late 2009, WUC submitted its final scoping report and was in a position to submit the final EIR, not the EIA as shown on this slide. It had completed its feasibility study and essentially was getting into a position where it wanted to move forward with final approvals. In 2009, the industry, through the various companies, engaged Water Affairs on a high level on how to advance the solution. And those discussions carried on through 2010 and then into 2011, which, as you know, led to the creation of the Interministerial Committee, the team of experts, and a whole number of alternatives were reviewed by the various teams involved in this. During 2011, we as individual companies presented ideas to the IMC's technical team, and in particular, we not only focused on the long-term solution, but more importantly, recognizing that a long-term solution would take time, we presented some emergency measures to speed up the rate at which we were dealing with this AMD. We believe that there is a lot of thought required to implement a long-term solution. But however, we aren't moving fast enough, we believe, as an industry and as regulators, and indeed as government and civil society, to deal with this problem, and we need to speed up the activities. Since the IMC report, the industry and the individual companies have engaged extensively with TCTA and Water Affairs. And indeed, we're delighted with the appointment of TCTA. They bring an engineering rigor as well as an institutional capability to solving this that we certainly as an industry would like to embrace. And would really, as I will say further on, really like to recommend to this committee that we endorse the activity of TCTA and in fact give them additional resources to speed up their activity. They are the right organization to move forward.
You'll give them resources?
No. I'll show you the resources we're deploying already. And it's an important point, Chairman, because the industry, and particularly small companies like ours, have deployed masses of resources. And we would like to see people standing next to us to find a collective solution to this. And in conclusion, from an overview point of view, unfortunately today the challenge remains. There's been a huge amount of work done and a lot of talking and engagement, but we aren't acting on the ground fast enough. And if nothing else, I'd like to use this opportunity with the committee to respectfully request we speed up activity. We broadly all know where we're going. There's a lot of work required, but there's also more we can be doing, we believe, collectively on emergency solutions. The seriousness of this problem has been recognized long ago, as evidenced by the Honourable Minister's speech, in fact, when she visited our site. I think it's becoming clear that this is a legacy issue, and that spending all our time finding culprits may well be a waste of resources. There are new operators in this area, particularly on the Western Central Basin. These companies are brand new. They simply could not have created this problem. And as we each talk, we'll show you how that can be the case. And as a result, burdening these new companies with the sins of the past is simply unsustainable. These companies will collapse. And so not only will we not have a solution, we won't have mining in the central and western and indeed eastern basin. So we'll lose a whole lot of jobs. And we believe that is not the right way to go. There's an accepted principle of the polluter pays. Companies that didn't create this problem simply cannot be expected to use their shareholders' money or indeed creditors' money to solve other people's problems. However, these companies have committed very substantial amounts of resources to solving this problem. And we'll continue to do that because we believe that someone has to and that we can provide a very strong partnership with government and civil society to find a solution. Because resolution is critical to the environment and particularly the sensitive environment in which we are operating. And it's essential to the recovery of mining in the Gauteng area. We know what a big engine mining can be for the economy. It's been clearly flagged as an opportunity in the creation of jobs. But if we don't solve this, we can understand why communities would say, we simply don't want mining in our backyard. If you can't deal with what happened in the past, don't come and try and operate in the future. And hence, our job as a new operator has been to say, if we're going to try and build a modern mining business, we have to be part of finding a solution. And this is where we turn to the good news. We do believe that a solution has been presented by the mining companies working through WUC. This was presented in 2009 and 2010. Now, if there's one thing that you take away today, I'd really like you to understand the point that I've highlighted and underlined there. And that is that in recognizing that this solution has to be funded by someone, that's the easy part. We also recognize it's going to be very hard to find the culprits who created this. It's more than likely they are all gone and those companies no longer exist. And even if you can find some companies, you'll never hold them accountable because of the complexity of acid mine drainage and how mining, underground mining works and how the AMD actually is created. So recognizing those two challenges, the industry believes that the best solution to this problem is to find an economically viable solution. We believe that AMD is a valuable resource that can be turned into a scarce resource, which is potable water. If we do that, we believe that an economically viable business can be created. This business can attract external funding, and that has been demonstrated by the work feasibility work has undertaken. So if we can attract independent capital to this problem, make it an attractive business for them, then they needn't be reliant on the state or mining companies. And what's also important about not trying to lie on the companies too hard is that when they go away, which they inevitably will, who's going to solve this? We want to create a long-term, sustainable, economically viable and attractive business. After sewerage, AMD is the next best source of potable water. And in this country, we talk about desalination of seawater as an alternative for creating potable water. That's crazy compared to turning AMD into potable water as the first option. AMD is much cheaper to convert to potable water than many other sources. Unfortunately, the industry has been unsuccessful in presenting its case as to why the WOC solution should be taken forward. However, there's been a lot of work done by government through the IMC and the technical teams to look at alternatives. And we'd love to work with government as an industry to find a solution going forward. But we'd also point out that the window is closing. And a good example of that is that there are mines in the Central Basin that are busy being flooded. And if they go out of business, they simply can't be helpful in finding a solution. So the industry is under threat from this AMD, as is the environment, as are some people. So it's important that we step up our activities to get this solution in place as soon as possible. Chairman, that's the overview. If you'd like to take questions at that point, alternatively we can go to the individual companies.
I think you guys must not be so cavalier about the ownerlessness. You know, people want to see who the culprit. May not necessarily be the most practical approach, but people want to see who the culprit is. So I think you must be very careful in your cavalier approach as an industry to say that this thing is ownerless and you can't deal with it and so on. I really, that kind of approach worries me. It may very well be that litigation hasn't succeeded against you because maybe that the litigation has been brought has been quite pathetic. Maybe if you get a real firm of lawyers to actually tackle this issue, put all the nexus and the evidence together. So that's why I'm saying you must be careful with that, because what it does is it immediately rubs you up wrongly. As I said, yeah, and when you tell me those things, it may be because I understand why you would say it, because clearly you would not want to come here and accept any responsibility. Secondly, you know, new mines that have started under the new environmental laws, everything, you go and buy a new mine, and you know very well that there's water down there. To then say you've got no responsibility to deal with it, it's just, legally, it's just untenable. Because clearly, when you bought the mine, every one of us, you know that this history is going on since, in fact, I've got some new documents here. I see already in 57 there was a commission of government. I see there's an accord that was signed at some stage in the 70s, etc., etc. So this is a long thing going. So if new mines have been created, with the new environmental laws, for them to suggest that, well, they can't take on the responsibility. Well, who will? They took on the responsibility knowing that the water's there. So that's the first thing I just want to say to the mining industry. Please, let us, if you want us to deal with this thing in a civil manner, in a practical way, as I have been advocating as a chairperson, then I think you guys must be careful to be cavalier about the things that you say. But having said that, I appreciate the history that you've given us. The other thing that I worry about is that the solution you give us gives you no responsibility whatsoever in any capacity. There's no doubt that if, of course, we can get an economically viable solution to the problem, as I've been saying in these meetings and all the members have been saying, we mustn't see this necessarily as a problem, but as an opportunity in a water scare country. So we agree with that approach. But the problem is, the mines can't be completely out of this in the end, and we just give the problem to someone else. So I make those comments up front, just so to please bear that in mind in the rest of your input. Okay, some questions, Mr. Morgan? Sorry, can I just say to the members, you'll see that there are three written submissions, obviously, which... One is by the Center for Environmental Rights that deal with a lot of the legal issues, FEDUSA, and the Federation of a Sustainable Environment. They're quite interesting submissions. Are they handed out? Have they been handed out? Okay. Just bear that in mind. There are three written submissions that have just come to hand. Okay. Okay, Mr. Morgan.
Thanks, Chairperson. And thank you very much for the presentation. My thoughts are somewhat similar to yours, Chairperson. I accept that it might be different.
Excuse me. I don't like TV cameras here. Could you go and stand and take it to the back, please? Please, I don't. This completely disrupts the meeting in my experience in 14 years, well, 17 years of Parliament. Could cameras please be in the back, and then you can photograph as much as you like. Everyone, give your left side. These people here, give their right side, your good side, so the cameras can see you. Anywhere at the back there is fine, okay? All right. Thank you very much. Try again, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your initial comments. I'm left with somewhat the same feeling at the start of the meeting, and I mean, I'm well aware of the work, and I think there's some great merit there. Some of us were briefed on it last year. I accept as well that it's difficult to work out the apportionment, and I know that there's been an attempt to do it before, and there are various complexities about it. But what there surely has to be is an acknowledgement by the mines, whether it be the ones in the Western Basin or the Central Basin or Aurora. They own properties where there are mine voids, where there is water interacting with rock faces, which is causing acid mine drainage. It might not be the entire compartments. There are arguably, or there probably are, abandoned mines or ownerless mines. But the mines all own properties which, and you know, and hence own those voids, which are causing AMD on an ongoing basis. And I accept that working out that percentage of the total is probably very, very difficult. But there nevertheless is a responsibility. You own properties and mines, whether they be mined or not, that are causing AMD. And even if those areas were mined before the current owners bought these properties, the due diligence would have said, we buy this mine knowing that this is part of the legacy. So in that sense, there has to be an acknowledgement by mines that they are partly responsible. And the quibble is about how much are they responsible. So I don't think we should all be so quick to say, well, it's so difficult to work out liability, we must move on and find the next solution. There has to be an acknowledgement as well that we own properties that are contributing to acid mine drainage. And it has to be, you know, certainly an acknowledgement to everyone in this room. I know you're not going to acknowledge and say I'm responsible for 23.5% of the water coming out of your own property. And I accept that the water coming out of your own property is from all over that basin, which is, you know, significantly bigger than your property. So I think there has to be an acknowledgement that you are responsible for part of the problem, even if, as you say, Rand Uranium is a new plan. I will engage, no doubt, with many other, with the mines and with the work later on in the day, and I look forward to that very much. I am also then very interested in you commenting on this. You're very quick to say we mustn't worry about the litigation or apportionment. What, from your point of view, has been your experience with that process to date? So the apportionment that was done, how did you respond to that? What work have you and other minds can maybe comment on it later in responding to it? That particular apportionment. And, I mean, you say that litigation would be hard. I mean, I accept it would be hard because the voids are massive. But there is extensive and continuous mining law going back the best part of a century now with regard to the discharge of mine water. Way back to 1911. There's a mining law from 1911. So, and granted, states and governments of the day throughout time may not have enforced all of that, but there is case law for taking on mines which were discharging water unrehabilitated into the environment. So, give us your impression of where this juncture comes. Why should the state not actually seek to take you and others to court and establish the owners of other mines? Just because a mine is abandoned does not necessarily mean it is ownerless. There are no doubt owners that can be tracked down.
Mm.
Now, I accept the point that, you know, maybe this is all just a lot of work. That's one argument, and there is an urgency about getting the AMD solution. But you're very quick to say, you know, the apportionment is not something we should worry much too about. But I want to know, you know, from your side, your response to the law over the last century. The way I can see it, I know the MPRDA is a new piece of legislation, but it's preceded by a whole bunch of legislation which holds mines responsible for the discharge of water. And surely when new owners buy mines, they buy those liabilities. So talk us through that stuff, because you were very keen to move over that stuff quite quickly today and talk about the solution. I'm very keen on the solution as well, but I need more from the mines about your take on the legal ramifications of mining. Go back to my first point. One of the reasons, of course, why mines, I believe, that are in the room today have to take, you know, have to say, well, we own mines that cause AMD, even if we don't own all of them, is that there has to be some contribution to fixing this problem going forward. And I know, I fully understand Rand Uranium is putting money and resources into the pumping, so I'm not being ungracious about that, but I'm looking for the long-term solution. I understand the basic mechanisms of what the WIP would be if it was accepted. But what would be the ongoing contribution of the mine, Rand Uranium, for example, to dealing with to contributing, presumably financially, to the remediation of acid mine drainage decant? I mean, it's fine for, the WIP will you know, raise capital, and it will desalinate water, and it will sell it on as potable water. That's one of the goals, or sell it on to various industries for different classes of water. But that just means you stop having responsibility, because you remain responsible for that water. My understanding of even the current law is you just don't lose responsibility for that water. And then at the point when Rand Uranium or any successor who may buy your operation finally ceases, closes down, and rehabilitates, we all know that the AMD problem doesn't just go away. It has to be treated, pumped and treated pretty much forever. How do you then basically take responsibility for that ongoing decant? I mean, I understand the concept of the work. I'm trying to link that with what you are responsible for by virtue of being the owner of a mine that is causing AMD, basically. Because you mentioned that the polluter pays principle shouldn't be outsourced. So I'm interested in you talking us through that, and I'm sure the WIP would as well, but as the CEO of one of the mines which is responsible for AMD, I want you to talk us through the polluter pays principle as you see it in relation to the concept of the WIP. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mr. Kiet, how many mines have we sent directives to over whatever period of time to tell them to deal with this matter?
Yeah, I don't have the figure with me, but definitely in the West Rand, we've sent directors to 3 mines on several locations, starting in 2005.
Can someone give us a copy of all those directors?
We've got it, Jeff.
All of them. Make copies for us and give them today to us, okay?
We've got it, Jeff.
All right. Then what is our approach to this Fani Bota Accord, which I've only saw for the first time in my life today? You don't know it. It's something that the previous apartheid government signed with mines. What is our approach to it?
Chair, I think we still believe that we can follow that route. So in most cases, you know, we've got old mines that existed long before there was any legal sort of framework on environmental issues. We still follow that route.
What is the department's legal situation? This thing was signed in 76. So obviously it's binding on the state prior to 76. But since new environmental laws have come in, what would that do as far as this accord? Those laws, if they're in conflict with the accord, what is our situation?
Chair, we can't go back. I mean, if in 76 the Fani Bota Accord was tabled, and we still...
No, so it's a legally binding document. So that's what I'm saying.
It's a legally binding
document. I'm
saying
since then, environmental laws that were passed are in conflict with this.
Yes.
What is our take on it? What's the department's take on it?
Well, if you have new mines, the mines must follow the laws. I mean, I think Department of Mineral Energy started with their new laws in 1992. And since then, you know, we adhere to those laws from 92. That's DMR. And in water affairs, from 1998 with the New Water Act.
Right, get us those directives, because that gives us some legal basis to deal with things. So we can have a look at it, okay? The other thing I wanted to ask, Mr. Munro, how many mines in the West Basin, Central and East, are now operational?
In the Western Basin itself, nothing is operating. And in fact, just for context, so we own the property up there, tailings dam, but we own our operating mines are in a basin 30 kilometers to the south. It's the Cook Basin, it's the isolated area. And my colleagues can correct me, in the Central Basin, you've got some trial activity undertaken by Central Rand Gold, that's correct. ERPM is defunct. And then on the Eastern Basin, Aurora was active, and as you know, those operations have stopped and it's flooding. There is surface mining activity throughout those basins.
Now, I ask this question because the solution, which I think all of us would like to see in some form or the other, I'm trying to work out how much water the mining industry in Gauteng is using at the moment, and to what extent, if we were to get someone to turn the water that there is now into some other form, to what extent the mines can actually buy that water back and use it instead of using beautiful, potable, drinkable water at the moment?
Check. There is some rough numbers that Jaffu has got in his discussion on the work proposal that shows a significant component of grey water being used in surface mining operations. So that was considered as part of the bigger solution as to what's the maximum to be consumed in mining activities versus the surface.
But have we any, I mean, the mines in the Gauteng area which are relatively close by, have we got any idea how much decent drinking water they are using every single day now?
Mm-hmm. You can talk.
Talk. You've got the answer. You know, what I'm trying to work out is what kind of market have we got at the moment? I mean, in Gauteng. Have we got a market?
Out of the 3 basins, there's 155 megalitres of acid mine drainage. Of that 155 megalitres, a maximum of 60 megalitres can be consumed by industry within all 3 basins, and the balance of that part of the solution was then to convert that into potable water.
So you say 155 a day, correct, megaliters a day, of which 60 can be.
Maximum of 60, correct.
Maximum of 60. Now, so all the mines that are operating in Gauteng are only using 60 megaliters of water a day.
Yeah, that's in those basins. There, you get the Far West, which is then huge mining complexes, which they're probably net producers of water. They certainly produce more fresh water than they use. Potables really only used in very select applications where you need that sort of quality.
Correct. Currently, we we'll get to some of those in the next presentation. But the mining houses are consuming acid mine drainage as we speak for their own processes, and therefore reducing the liability on.
But are the mines also using potable water?
Very little, and it's for very specific processes where very high quality water is required. But very little.
Rough idea, Jay. Our company, we operate three underground, small underground gold mines and one surface operation. I think we use 2 to 3 megalitres a day of potable, and I might be actually wrong there. And it's in very, as Jacques said, it's like for sealing of pumps, where you need that high quality, or in human consumption and machine water.
So there is a capacity to at least use 60 megalitres in the immediate mines, and then if one goes further with it, there's a further possibility.
Correct, and the major consumers of that is surface operations. Which both Mkhali or Mintails and DRD through the urban operations and some of the other operations consume a majority of that water.
Okay, so that's a thought we can pursue further.
Chair, just a caveat, it does tend to be quite variable as the operations change in size. There's been a growth recently in surface mining operations in west and on the east, and it could be further growth. So it's a key part of any solution is to have some flexibility to deal with offtake for grey water, which is for mining as opposed to potable.
If we get a solution to this, well, at least we bring it under control and deal with it properly, whatever solution we use. Are there still deposits in this west and so on that are mineable that may then attract mines to start doing it and then have further usage of water bodies?
Yeah, you would open up underground mines, which don't tend to consume that much. But you would, I would look at it more from the point of view of you do at least protect mineral resource. It's not so much a consumption thing. I would think that's a small number, given there would be small, pretty modest underground mines. Johan, maybe you can give us a sense of how much potable your mine would use at times if you're up and running. Yeah, it's very small. But I think, Chair, the point is once it's potable, you should use it as a high-value resource, which is potable.
No, that's fine. I understand that. The problem is you want to minimize, if someone has to take on the responsibility for this, you don't want to go to that level if you're not going to be able to use the water. It's clearly going to be more expensive to get it to that level than other water is.
Yeah.
And it's much better to use it in the industries, industrial use and for mine. That's really the issue. Have you engaged the industry, though, the other industries, to see what possibilities there are for them to take up water?
Yes, sir, we have. We've looked at as far down as Sasolburg for Sasol. Secunda we've looked at. We've looked at the other refineries within the Germiston and the Springs areas. So all of that has been taken.
What are they saying?
No formal agreements has been entered into with any of those because of the problem that we're currently experiencing with the progress of the solution. We need formal authorization to proceed, and once we've got that, then we can obviously...
What kind of water do they need?
Again, they need two qualities. So there's certain processes that you can put onto treated water, or what we refer to as grey water, and then there are certain processes that you need very high quality water for. So a certain amount of any industry's water consumption can be subsidized with
But isn't that the job for you guys to do? I mean, isn't that your responsibility then, to actually call all these people together and see how much other people we can get to use some of the grey water?
Jay, I think that's a very key point. If you're going to advance this, we need to know it's with a mandate. And that's part of what, as a broader issue I'd like to frame, is that there was a mandate given to industry to go and find this. And it was prevented. And that's 2 years ago. So that would be, I mean...
There's now been an interministerial committee. They've come up with findings and they're responding to this. And we as a committee will make sure that they respond quickly. They're coming back in August to come and tell us
what other solutions there are. So there's definitely things that are moving. This committee's approach is simply this. If there are people that are legally liable to pay for these things or have criminal charges against them and have the stigma of criminal charges against them, then that let that happen if it has to happen. Our approach was, Department of Water, you're responsible to stop water flowing into our rivers, which is polluted. So in the meantime, you must do what you have to do to stop that. Then if you want to take legal action against anyone else, you can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, the legal principle is fine. You can later on then recover the money that you have to spend to do this. That's been our approach to it. So, and then, of course, we've had the Interministerial Committee that's clearly now dealing with the issue itself. So everyone's dealing with this. I mean, everyone has come on board now. I mean, I'm going to engage the provincial government, Gauteng government, to see whether they also can't start engaging and see where else we can use grey water. Because if we've got a lot of clients for grey water up front, then it becomes much easier for us to find solutions to that kind of partnership. But I think, you know, it's important that the mines start seeing, you know, put it in more in specifics in terms of how much water we can use in this area, plus the industries that are close by. See to what extent, how much grey water they would use if it were to be available. You know, because that opens up a lot of possibilities. And, you know, you as mines, if you want us to, you want this nation to say, well, fine, you know, let the past be the past, which they may or may not do, then, of course, you must be forthcoming in helping us be able to do that. I mean, you know, we can't just have a debate on ownerlessness and crow about that. It has to be something more substantial. So I'm just saying that will go a long way to start helping us to find this, and it will particularly help Mr. Kiert and them, because part of their mandate from us is that I don't want to see, personally, would not want to see neutralized water pumped into any river. The Tweelopie spray is dead. It will take a long time to recover. We're going to pump water into the Klip River, which is going to be more dead than it is already. And we want to start recovering those. It's not a very good solution for environmentalists and water affairs departments to come up with solutions that pollute our rivers. It's not a very good idea. So if we can take the neutralized water and immediately have clients for it, then we can then start looking at desalination. For the extra water that we're going to pump out, then start making that potable. At least in the short term, if we can start moving the water elsewhere and get clients for it, it would help us a lot. So I think this is a big job for the mining industry to take up and see to what extent we can. And as I said, I'm also going to engage the Gauteng government. It's good that they're here, because we can start seeing whether there aren't other sources. I've always thought, for example, I love golf. I mean, I'm an avid golfer, but, you know, these places use tons of water. I mean, what alternative water sources can we use except potable water that we're pumping and keeping these greens green for me to be able to play on? There might be solutions like this. And the issue is we must start thinking of those solutions. When the solutions start coming, we'll stop pointing fingers. While there are no solutions, I mean, if you look at these submissions we've received, then all they want to see is blood. The written solutions, these ones, and give them to you. They want to see liability. They give us all the laws here. I mean, they spelled them out. That's what they want to see. That's clearly what ordinary people want to see. They want to see someone pay for what they are seeing. Now, that may or may not be a good solution. I'm trying to let us push pragmatically and solve this thing, that water stops pumping into the rivers. So that's more my answer with it. Mr. Tsetse, I'll give you a chance. Let them just answer Mr. Morgan's first question, and we'll come back to more questions. We'll be more time for questions.
Jacob, can I just pick up on your point about a solution? In terms of, and I'm just speaking for our company, but I think it's similar for the other companies, we're not wedded to the WOOC solution. There are elements that we think are clever and smart, but there's all manner of variants on it that the industry would support. And I think the other point I'd just like to make is that the feasibility done by WOOC was completed in 2009. The world has changed since then. One of the big changes is that potable water is now
25% more expensive than it was last year, and next year will be 25% more expensive. So consumption patterns are changing, where grey water is becoming, you know, suddenly people figured out they can use it. So there is a lot of scope to relook at the idea. It's a question of a collective mandate to go and do that. And the industry, you know, and I think it's important that I respond overall to your comment about the ownerlessness. It's not the point to make that the emphasis, and I hope that will come across in the individual company's presentation. If you look at the way we've structured ours, it's talk about what we're doing on the basis we believe someone has to do something. And that will continue to be the industry's attitude. If we believe that it was just an ownerless thing and really I would like to emphasize that we're not cavalier about it. If that was the case, we wouldn't be spending 2.5 million rand a month or some 25% of our executive time on lobbying to find a solution. This is terribly serious for the industry. We will not be able to build a modern industry if we just stand by and watch this, let alone the environment, social, and other issues associated with that. So it's not a question of really dismissing the questions of liability and apportionment. It's a question of what can we do proactively going forward, and I echo the Chairman's sentiments about doing that. In terms of answering Mr. Morgan's questions, I'll try and frame it holistically. For instance, from our company's point of view, we've taken advice on, we've got this water overflowing in our property, what should we do? And the advice has been, you have to take reasonable measures to mitigate its impact. However, you can't assume overall liability for it. And the question of what's reasonable measures, the tests were, you know, is it going to destroy your company? Are you unreasonably spending shelter money? So hence our operations through thick and thin to operate the water treatment plant, despite the fact that our company is not making a hell of a lot of money. And indeed, it's a growth company where we are, you know, slowly putting together a long-term business. But the other part of reasonable measures has been to drive with practical considerations the development of a sustainable solution that is bigger than the individual companies, because individual companies, simply this is too big for them. So that's been our practical response to the question of, well, where do we stand legally? I think we're, and again, to try and answer your, as broadly as I can, the question about the 100 years of body of law, as I understand it, the biggest single failing has been that it was the application of the law in previous decades that has been the problem, where when people shut down operations, they weren't required to close them. I mean, that idea of closing a mine to an acceptable standard has been around for a period. But generally that has not happened, and hence we have these abandoned mines that are producing AMD. And as it goes to the individual companies, you'll see each individual specific situation and what they're doing. But it's not a question of dismissing obligations. It's a question of finding a practical balance. And that's how we try to actually present this, is to say an emphasis on one or the other is taking us nowhere. And so we'd like to tell you what we're doing practically, but also give you a sense of where we stand legally. Not that we want to have a debate about it or cast ourselves in a particular light, but more to say, this is the background, but let's focus on the practical solutions way forward. We clearly recognize that someone always wants a culprit. I mean, that's the nature of man. Now, I'm trying to think of the other dimensions of your question that I've missed. Is anything particular? Okay. This is clearly going to be a question. Well, how much are you going to put on the table? I can't answer that without knowing what the solution would look like. What is the contribution of other parties? How can I justify spending my shareholders' money or creditors' money on a solution if we are assuming a liability that we don't necessarily have? I think, though, that to give you some guidance, look at the commitments the industry has made already. And I think that the industry is quite prepared, and I shouldn't use the term industry because there's no such thing. There is no such thing as the industry. The industry is made up of individual companies with their own individual views, positions, liabilities, balance sheets, and ability to commit to things. So I think that what you'll see is the mining companies have demonstrated a willingness to work collectively to find a solution to this. And if that involves a financial commitment, then we'll look at the scale of it and see, is that reasonable in the context of the bigger legal position as well as the practical solution. So it's not a question of the industry saying, hands off, we're not spending a cent. It's a huge thing that consumes part of my time. And, you know, for a company that our mining operations consume about 100 million rand a month in expenditure, another 2.5 on top of that doesn't sound like very much. But trust me, when your margins are as tight as they are in the gold mining business, 2.5 million rand is a lot of money to be putting into something that is in fact not a good solution. You know, as you say, putting neutralized water down the river is not a good solution, but it is better than untreated AMD going down the river. Hence, doing the best that we possibly can under the circumstances. Mr. Tessie?
You can raise anything you like.
Just a concern on the social aspect of the situation. That what is the proximity of the human settlement from these many activities? And is there any report as to how communities are affected by the situation?
Through you, Chairman.
Dr. Kwan?
Apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. From your presentation, you say it's 2011 mining company present the proposal to the IMC for the technical team. So I'd like to know is what proposal for the IMC. From the IMC, this report, I think it is 2010 December. So this 2011, I don't think so this one involved. I'd like to hear from the IMC side how is they receiving for this a proposal from the your side regarding for the technique issue. Then you say the mining company engaged with the water offer and the TCTA. This proposal released from the also from the IMC this the report. I'd like the more information what you need from the TCTA side. Are you to the emerging from the TCT? Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Morgan?
Thanks, Chair. It's very similar to Mr. Wong. You presented some views. What do you need government to do? I mean, let's say we accept what you just said, what do you need government to do in terms of directives, in terms of regulations, things to speed all of this up? You seem obviously very keen, you want to do it. It's important for a number of different reasons, the environment, local communities, your shareholders, the reputation of the business. The second the second thing is a follow-on from your previous one, and perhaps the work would talk about it, but I suspect it would be more you. Surely at the end of the day, there's still going to have to be an apportionment of liability because you are going to, I mean, the idea is, if, let's say the work gets to go ahead, the directives happen, whatever, there still has to be some agreement between you and other companies to contribute to it, and there has to be in terms of percentages. So you're going to take on a voluntary apportionment of sorts, and presumably, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's going to be some apportionment to the state as well. You're going to say, well, we think we're responsible for this, or this roundabout here, and these guys are that, and that, and that, and the rest, the abandoned, the ownerless, the historical stuff that we don't know, is going to be the state. So while there's been an attempt to create an apportionment which kind of divvies it all up, there is going to, in the end, be an apportionment because otherwise, I mean, you can't go to your shareholders anyway and say, I'm going to contribute X million to the capital cost and a bit to the operating cost while we get these guys sustainable. They're going to say, well, that's too much or that's, you know what I mean? So there's going to be apportionment anyway. It's just going to be presumably a negotiation between you and the state if this goes ahead. Your comments on that, please.
Yeah, sure. Any other questions? Dr. Huang, another one?
Sorry, Chairperson, I forgot this. For your presentation, you say is for the Eastern Basin is 15 megaliter per day. I don't know is I hear it wrong. You say the Eastern Basin is 15 megaliter, and Central Basin is 60 megaliter, and the Western is 100 megaliter.
Let's just clarify. Western Basin is about 15 megaliters a day.
Oh, 15.
Central, 60.
Yeah.
And in 82, sorry, for the east.
But only the western is decanting.
Yes.
East the whole.
Must be pumped, that amount must be pumped out to keep it below the, properly below the ecological safety level. Yes.
And Chair, can I just emphasize that?
The 154 altogether. 55. 155.
No, because I checked what I found there is IMC reports.
Yeah.
Inside the indicator is the western is 40 megaliters, and the central is 60, and the eastern is 108. So not only 155, it's always. Yeah, it's already 200 megaliters per day.
You're saying that report says the western is 108?
Yeah, 108. So I just say
well, probably I imagine what that is. It's decanting at the moment at 30.
Yeah, you say the west 30.
So it decants at 30, but to bring it below the ecological safety line, because now it's above that, you're going to have to pump it down. So I imagine that's why the east-western basin has got it. But once you've got it below the ecological level, then clearly it's only going to be a certain amount of water that has to be kept at that level.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it's full. That's why it's running out. So it is above the ecologically safe line. So you have to pump. But answer the question in terms of how much...
Chair, can I just perhaps give more clarity on that? The numbers we refer to, the 155 megalitres, that is based on a daily annualized average worked out over a year period. Remember, during the summer period, you'll have more rain and therefore more ingress. During the winter period, you don't have rain and therefore you've got less ingress. So if you calculate it over a year period, that is the daily annualized average to keep the volumes within the basin constant. So depending and sustainable. So depending on when the measurement was taken, obviously that will depend on what the decant or the rate of rise at that specific moment would be. But over a year period, you're talking about 155 megalitres.
How much do you have to pump to get it to the western basin below the ecologically safe line?
Currently, the level within the western basin is about 7 meters above the decant point. To get it just below decant is...
the ecologically safe line.
Yeah. That is in itself a very interesting question because we're of the opinion that the ECL should be 23 meters. The IMC has come out with a report that states it should be lower. So,
what do they say?
I think they said 100 meters on the Western Basin model.
The latest that was done by the monitoring committee is 160 meters.
Oh, okay. So
that's the safe.
That's the environmental critical level in Western Basin.
So you must go 100. So you'll have to pump out 160.
Correct.
To get to below that line.
That's correct.
All of it above that you'll have to pump out.
Correct.
To get to that line.
Chair, I think a broader answer to your question about how much should you pump now to get it down, our estimate is at least 40. If you start at 40, you start to make progress.
Start going down.
Especially during winter. We've seen the maximum it can get to is over 60, but if you've built up headroom, you can deal with the surge.
Okay, just answer the other question.
Sure. Maybe I can start with Dr. Cohen's questions about PCTA needs and Morgan follow-on. Can I deal with those when we talk about rand uranium? Because there we start to come to some specifics about immediate action. And so I'll deal with all the TCTA questions then. And it's not so much a question of what do we need, it's what do we get to do collectively. I'd like to go back into the first question regarding community. There is a monthly monitoring committee as well as a quarterly community as well as the regulator and mining company monitoring committee to look at community impacts. Where community impacts have been identified, the industry working through those WEBEC and CBEC have tended to help put in solutions. For instance, boreholes in the Krugersdorp Game Reserve to give safe water to the animals. There was a community downstream that was affected, so a borehole was contributed there. With the very high rainfall that we had farmers downstream having roads washed away and that sort of thing. So the industry helped with, or the companies helped with, earth-moving equipment. There has been, so far, no large-scale impact on communities reported. However, we think that's just temporary. Should this continue, it eventually will start to affect communities more broadly. But so far, what happens is the water from the Western Basin decants, that water that's not treated, goes down the Tuilerpies and eventually goes into a very large compartment underground where it gets mixed with other water. So we don't see bigger impacts downstream.
but I would only regard that as temporary and as no means for taking comfort from anything. There's also been a theory that this water joins with sewerage effluent and that helps shield the rot. I don't think any of that's a good thing to take heart in. We need to put in place solutions. But in simple answer to the question, where community impacts have been identified, action has been taken to alleviate that as best as possible. Then I would like to come to Mr. Morgan's question then on the negotiated settlement, for want of a better word. And I think that's the right sort of way to think of it, on the basis that at some point there's a justification to external parties and internal parties and how each party to this will contribute. But I think that the industry has really done a lot of thinking on that, because certain companies have an interest in the area being dewatered because it creates an opportunity for them. So they've indicated a willingness to contribute. Others have indicated, you know, a smaller ability to do it. So I do think that's a very constructive way to think of it, and it certainly is something the industry sees as happening at some point in the evolution of a solution. And again, I'd emphasize that it's not a question of the industry saying, here's work, like it or leave it. It's a question of, here's a solution, there are a whole lot of elements to it, let's take it forward. And hence, we do believe that the involvement of TCTA to evaluate the range of alternatives and the complexities is a big step forward to try and get to that point of what does a solution look like and how, if funding is needed, how should it be apportioned? Because there can be practical solutions to this. The industry has a huge vested interest in the solution here, as does everyone, in terms of creating an environment where mining can thrive. So it's not a question of, you know, hands off. I hope that gives you a broad answer to your question on how we see that element playing out. And it depends on the nature of the solution. Are we a benefit in terms of having access to cheap water or any water? You know, water is becoming increasingly scarce in Gauteng of any form. And particularly as the surface mining ramps up, that will be the case for the access to grey water. So I do think there's a pretty complex legal, social obligation / commercial consideration for each company that will play out over time.
All right, Mr. Huang, Dr. Huang, they'll answer your questions when they do the specific input on Rand Uranium.
Yeah, and each company will have different interests.
What about the American solution?
The levy.
I see you stare away from that like sin. I see the levy stands there. You move long berths around it. Nowhere part of your thinking or input. Isn't that the answer? Not for the past legacy, because you're going to have to deal with that. We're all going to have to pay price for that. But in terms of what we do for the future, how do we make sure that in the future, when you guys have suck the earth dry, left the mines there, and then we have sinkholes start happening. Whole townships start collapsing into the sinkhole. How do we deal with those legacies?
Well,
potential legacies.
Right. Chair, look, I think from the point of view on the go forward of active mines, the framework is very, and this therein really starts to tie into the question from Mr. Morgan about legislation. That is very well established in terms of financial provision, whereas the closure plan for the active mines that is then priced on an annual basis, and you know, we're required to have that fully provided at any point in time. And you know, at the moment our company runs a provision of some 300 million rand, which is the current estimate of future closure, and that gets updated annually with the department. So that framework is very well established, and that's in keeping with global practice on financial provision for closure, and it's a big hurdle to new entrants to the industry often, is that those numbers can be big. So that framework is very well established and being well policed and implemented by DMR.
So they tell you do X, Y, and Z, you do it. You die. God forbid.
Yeah.
Then your mind that you were running, something starts happening. Sinkholes start happening. Water starts flowing in. You're not there anymore. You've done everything the Department of Mineral Resources has told you to do. Who pays for those things? Now you're gone. All your shareholders have taken their money. They've got big yachts in the Mediterranean. Living the big life. Now my children sit here in Parliament. Mr. Tessie's children sit here in Parliament. They now have to deal with the problem. That's what I'm talking about. The problem is, at the moment, what the mining laws allow is for you to give that money up front, to make it available if you don't spend it like they tell you, and then to use it in whatever way if you don't do it. But the unforeseen circumstances are going to happen 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the line, which will happen. How do we cater for that? Or do we just leave it for a burden for our children? Like our previous ancestors left this burden for us. I think that's what you have to think about in terms of the levy. Not so much something that is to deal with those things. It's the unforeseen circumstances, and in the future, to build some kind of reserve to deal with these problems. But okay, let's leave it at that. We can ask further questions. Let's get on to Rand Uranium, I think, is the first submission. Yes. Do you want to give us your input? That's the general input we've got now, so let's go to some of the specifics, okay?
Well, I'm about to break the computer.
Chileka. She's not there. Where is Chileka?
The computer's locked itself.
Okay, go and take 3 minutes, go to dark holes, do things, and come back. We'll start in about 5 minutes' time. Yeah, Mr. Munro?
Since we came into existence.
So over the next few slides, I'll talk about our actual activities on the ground. And I'll talk about, first of all, our practical actions to combat the AMD. Then I'll speak about the actions to develop a long-term solution, and then the IMC engagements. And then I'll have a last slide on the unspeakable question. In terms of AMD treatment plant operations, we operate a plant that is called a high-density sludge plant. It is also referred to as a partial treatment plant. It removes the acidity from the water, the metals very successfully, but not all the sulfates. So it's not a complete desalination plant. Our plant operates at about 12 megaliters per day. We pump the AMD from underground. It is then treated through this plant and then released into the Tuilapi spread. This plant is running at about 50% of the rate at which the AMD is decanting at the moment. As I indicated, that the AMD decants today at about 15 megalitres a day, over and above the 12 megalitres that we pump from underground and treat. We have invested quite heavily in this plant to get it to do the best possible job that it can, i.e. to produce the best possible quality water. But there is a limitation in terms of what this design of plant can achieve. Desalination is a completely different step and a massively expensive step forward that needs to be optimized. Over time, we have spent a lot of time and effort in trying to get this plant to do the best possible job that it can. In 2010, when there was a particularly large decant from the Western Basin, we also worked with Water Affairs in executing certain emergency treatment measures on the behalf of Water Affairs to help alleviate the problem. That lasted for about 3 or 4 months. As I indicated earlier, we also provide assistance to affected parties downstream. The most significant effect we've seen has been on the Krugersdorp Dam Reserve, which is immediately adjacent to the decant point. But we've also helped with downstream flood control and alternative water sources downstream to affected communities. One thing I should point out in talking about our plant is that, as I indicated earlier, it was never meant to be a long-term solution. First of all, it's not a complete technical solution, but also it was only designed to last a few years, and we're in fact running out of placement capacity for the sludge that this plant produces. So we really are running against the clock to find an alternative solution going forward with parties like Water Affairs and TCTA. As I indicated, we also have extensive reporting to Water Affairs and interaction with Water Affairs and community groups through the various structures that were established around the Western Basin decant to make sure that parties who could be affected were aware of it and had a forum to express concerns. We've also facilitated
community awareness training and that sort of thing around the Western Basin decant as a good example of what shouldn't happen post-mining. Round numbers, our company came into existence at the end of 2008, and we've spent some 60 million rand since then on an order of magnitude. The rate today on a more reliable basis is about 2.5 million rand a month. That's direct costs of running the water treatment plant. That excludes the costs of the other personnel in this company that have spent a lot of time and effort on the development of a long-term solution. So that's just the day-to-day AMD treatment operations that are underway today in the Western Basin run on the Rand Uranium water treatment plant. Moving on to the second step, in terms of practical steps being taken, we've helped work with the rest of the mining companies in that area to secure the development of a long-term solution to the AMD. And again, I'll just, for the sake of clarity, emphasize, we're not attached to Wook, and I'm afraid I'll sacrifice Yaku if I have to. But we do believe a lot of very good work has been done through the Wook process, and our desire would be that taken into account and used to expedite a solution rather than to reinvent the wheel. But we're not attached to Yaku, unfortunately, and we're not attached to its technology. If it's a better technology, we'd be more than happy to look at it. We'd just like to see a solution. But we have supported Wook. That was in response to the directive in 2005, where Water Affairs directed various companies to go and find a solution. And the industry in that area, working collectively, then did various work and then eventually spawned Wook that went about the feasibility study and the permitting that I've spoken about earlier. We've put huge amounts of manpower into the not only supporting Wook, working with them, providing information to them, but probably most importantly in the lobbying and working with government departments as well as NGOs and civil society to get this solution on the table and accept it. And that's really the last point. We have spent an inordinate amount of resources on championing the implementation of a long-term solution, and I really won't talk through this, but it, you know, in the life that that I've been involved in this company, really late in 2009 when the Wook solution was really proven, and that's when we kicked into gear to try and get this solution accepted, and it's been through a number of review sessions and discussions and, as you know, evolutions, and ultimately in September 2010 at the bottom, the presentation to the IMC's team of experts where our version of what could be done, amended for known changes of requirements, was presented to that team late last year. So a lot of work has been done by us, but it has been collaborative. It's the only way to do this. The size of the challenge requires collaborative work. And then finally, on to the IMC engagement, and I'd like to pick up those questions here. As I said, we presented not only our view on the long term, but also the immediate priorities to the technical team in September 2010. And then on the back of the IMC report, we then, revised our proposals to try and meet the requirements that the IMC report had identified. And I think just an important context for the IMC vis-a-vis the Wook proposal, it is key to see it that, as I understand it, one of the key questions put to Water Affairs and ultimately to the IMC task team was, okay, this is what the industry thinks, what do you think? And that has been a key part of all the work that has been done. But we are reaching the point where we need to start to say we collectively think this is the right thing to do because that's what the technical experts believe is the best solution. But the key outcomes as we see it from the IMC in terms of action was a recommendation that obviously a long-term sustainable solution had to be found. But more importantly, we saw in terms of part of what the chairman said this committee's mandate was, is immediate action is required to stem the tide, to deal with the existing decant on the west and start to stop the rise of the AMD in the central basin. And for better or for worse, the IMC, as I understand it, and have read the report, said at least let's use neutralization as the first step. It's not ideal and it's not a long-term solution, but it is better than nothing. And I think it's a key message that I've taken away from discussions with Water Affairs over the last 2 years, and it has been that sure, we have to have a long-term solution that produces a great quality project, but at least to stem the tide, let's at least get back this mine water to where it was before, which is at least it's neutralized and metals have been dropped out.
So I do understand that within water affairs it's seen that it's the lesser of two evils, at least as a temporary solution, to be operating these partial water treatment plants such that is happening on the Western Basin at the moment, albeit not at a sufficient scale. So in recognizing that the immediate priorities was to treat more of the AMD and to continue neutralization, we've presented various ideas and discussed them with the IMC's task team, and then in due course with TCTA, Water Affairs, and in fact National Treasury has been involved in some of those discussions. And the three sub-bullets I've got there are really what we regard as the emergency measures, the things we could do fast to stem the damage being done in the Western Basin. And there's really two options. The first option that we've put on the table is to expand the capacity of our treatment plant and then link it to the Mintails water treatment plant, because collectively it can treat more using the two different plants together than individually. They have slightly different designs and capacity available. So we believe that an emergency action could be taken to increase the rate of treatment of AMD from about 12 megaliters per day, which is currently happening, up to some 40 megaliters per day within approximately 1 to 2 months, once we commit to that solution. And that would cost, we estimate, about 25 million rand. It's a stopgap, and it's probably going to be sunk capital, but at least it will more than likely stop untreated AMD decanting down the Tweelopies in coming years. So that's the first option that we proposed, is to expand the capacity of existing plants and to operate as one big facility. One of the things that makes the operation of these plants expensive is people. So if you can have one team operating it, you can obviously operate the two plants better together than as individual plants. The alternative that the industry has suggested, which has got warts on it, but you know, it's a question of lesser of two evils, would be to actually pump the AMD out of the Western Basin into the Central Basin. Now, the reason that's an idea that has gained some traction, it has its critics, is that at least then you could well be spending money that then could be used for the long-term solution. And the reason I say that is that the WOOC solution contemplated one central treatment plant in the Central Basin. So the plan was to pump AMD from the Western Basin into the Central and then pump it out at one point in the Central Basin and treat it all in one big central facility. So if capital was spent, and it's of the order of 40 million rand, on transferring AMD from west to central, that capital would likely be for the long term. However, there are concerns from scientists that would be moving the problem from one place to another, that the underground dynamics of the water flow is not understood, you could end up with blockages. So there are some concerns that would need to be considered more fully. But those are just two alternatives that we proposed as the emergency measures. Now, again, we're not wedded to anything in particular. What we're wedded to is the idea of immediate emergency action to at least expand Western Basin AMD treatment rates well beyond where they are today. Our objective would be to do this within a month or two. What we want to do is capture this period of no rain on the West Rand to draw the level in the basin down, such that when it comes summer and you have these huge rainfall events, that you then have some buffer, such that we don't have these huge overflow events. The overflow is, in fact, particularly damaging because you have very large volumes of AMD and then the flooding effect. And although the mechanism for AMD generation seems complex, from the time a rainstorm event happens to the time the overflow accelerates, it can be very fast. It's in a matter of hours. So you can see rainfall events pushing the water out from the Western Basin. So our priority has been to get emergency measures to step up the rate of treatment on the Western Basin, utilizing existing facilities, expanding them, bringing to bear the capacity of TCTA, the mining companies, and the best thinking of it, including oversight from Water Affairs, to get this stepped up ASAP. And that then buys time for the long-term solution to come to fruition. In terms of the questions about what have we done with TCTA, we've had multiple meetings at my level, at our technical level. There have been site visits, provision of information. We've really tried to work as closely as we can with TCTA. And we found them to be a very capable partner firm that can take us forward. As described by one of my colleagues, this is a firm of engineers that delivers solutions. One of the frustrations has been there's been a lot of scientific and academic discussion about this. The time for action is now. And particularly on the emergency measures, it's about engineering solutions and doing things on the ground. And TCTA has demonstrated not only in its track record, but in engagements with us, that they focus on the right issues fast about okay, how do we deal with this? What about that? So if there's one thing I recommend, and I would like to make a closing at the end, Chairman, if you'd allow me, that we do back this capability that this country has to be a center of excellence and the capability to bring all the ideas together. Again, the IMC has put it to various government departments and water affairs. Is, what do you think? You can't just take the industry's word for it, which is a fair enough position. And I do think TCETA is the right people to be working with water affairs to find a solution, obviously under the oversight of National Treasury. In the meantime, we've continued the operation of our water treatment plants. But if you were to ask me in terms of emergency measures, what do we need to do? We need to ask TCTA, and there's a whole lot of reasons why things are taking time, because it's a complex situation with a lot of variables, in particular questions about if we would spend $25 million today on the West Strand plant, is it wasted for the long term? And I don't think there's absolute answers in that, because the development of the long-term solution is going to take a long time. It's not there yet. I do think that the input of all the people in the IMC is going to change the WOOP solution. It may take elements of that. So that is going to take time, and for that to be the long-term solution, it's going to take time to get there. We must put in place temporary measures to deal with the immediate problem, such that the pressure is taken off getting the long-term solution absolutely right. And so to summarize that, I would say that this committee could emphasize...
No, move on. Don't summarize.
I'll be as quick on this slide. Just a little bit about our company, because the artists and facts are real. Our company was formed at the end of 2008. It's a brand new company. It was formed to develop the Cook mines, which are located to the south, as well as to build a uranium business. We've not undertaken mining in the Western Basin. We have a tailings dam in that area, and we, as I said earlier, operate the AMD plant that sits above the Western Basin. Our existing mines are 20 kilometers away at the Cook shafts, which are in a different basin, and that water is dealt with in its own way. We acquired the property on which the AMD decants, and as part of that acquisition, we committed to the process that was underway. The process was very clearly defined in 2008 as operate the water treatment plant as an interim step and develop a long-term solution. And the long-term solution had the backing of all the parties that were involved at that point in time. So it was on that basis that we got involved in this thing. A little bit about the governance of it, and I won't go into detail because it's complex, but there were various directives put in place to govern the operation of the water treatment plant. There has been considerable legal activity not to stop the water treatment plant, but to get the governance of them appropriate. And in fact, despite there has been legal action where we were issued a directive in 2009, we appealed it and eventually went to the Water Tribunal. The directive was withdrawn. There were further discussions, and a new directive was issued in 2010. And there were certain aspects that we could live with, certain aspects we couldn't, and then there's an appeal on that. Although that's the case, what I would emphasize is that notwithstanding all of that, we have worked very closely with Water Affairs to find a solution that we can live with. The challenge we've had with these directives is that, as I indicated earlier, the water treatment plant can only produce certain quality water. It can't produce potable water. And as a result, we have been successful, we believe, in working with Water Affairs to agree what is a reasonable standard that we must operate the plant to. And that was actually achieved in the 2010 directive, but it was a short-term directive. So we're in discussions with Water Affairs now to get in place a governance framework, because we can't continue to operate the water treatment plant in a legal vacuum, but recognize it's a complex situation. So I really would emphasize the governance thing is, as you described it earlier, Chairman, not a sideshow, but it's a parallel course of action. We continue to work with Water Affairs and indeed other community and NGO interests to do the best job that we can with the infrastructure that we have there. As I've indicated, I emphasize the position that we have. So in summary, from a Rand Uranium perspective, people often say to us under the first bullet, well, if you only came here in 2008, why don't you just stand by and let this be someone else's problem? And the answer to that is very simple, is that we first of all, the water decants on our land, as I indicated in answer to Mr. Morgan's question earlier. So we have an obligation to do the best we can to mitigate the impact of that. But there are some parallels to if the manhole cover on the sewage pipe on your property bursts, what you have to do and what you don't have to do. You do have an obligation to actually mitigate it to the extent that you can, but you can't go and fix the sewage works. And that's a very crude analysis. But back to the rationale. We are attempting to build a modern mining business in the West Rand, not just for the good of mankind, but for the benefit of our shareholders. And that can be done, but we don't believe we can do it and permit large-scale mining businesses in the future if the mining industry and regulators collectively stand by and watch something of this magnitude going on. Hence the commitment that we made when we took over this property to do the best that we can with the existing resources in terms of operating the water treatment plant, but also supporting the development of a long-term solution. And that is the rationale about why we go about this, as well as obviously doing the what we understand to be our legal obligation. We've undertaken massive engagement with all parties to argue for action and to move forward on the implementation of a long-term solution. And again, in closing, I'd like to emphasize that, again, and with respect, not being cavalier about the legal issues here, and sensitive to the position of mining in this country generally, and the question of legacy issues across the board, we do think that the focus on maximizing the value of the water to create a long-term, sustainable, economically viable, and to the extent possible, externally funded business is a really smart way to obviate the extensive resources that may go into litigation, which may happen in parallel. As I said, we propose various short and long-term measures, but we do think we're at a critical decision point. A lot of work has been done by government, a lot of work has been done by industry, and we need to pull it together and start to turn it into action on the ground. And that would be our biggest request, is to get that happening in terms of emergency measures. Thank you, Chair.
Questions? Just the specifics of this mine, it's not much detail there. That we, nothing more that we haven't heard in the other. Mr. Morgan?
Just some clarity. Thank you very much for the presentation. I saw some clarity. I from Mining Weekly, it seems as if you've been acquired by Gold One.
Yeah.
Does that do you remain Rand Uranium?
Yeah.
Going forward?
Yeah. Yes. So the legal entity Rand Uranium is the mining company that owns the rights and undertakes the business, and our shareholders are selling that business to Gold One. And for very, the question may well be why. And the rationale is simple, and that is that our company was originally set out to be primarily a uranium production business, continuing the operation of the Cook Underground Gold Mine, which do contain uranium as well. The state of the market generally, and specifically the impact of the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, has meant that the development of large-scale uranium businesses has become very difficult and certainly undoable in the next period, whether that's 6 months or 2.5 years, is unclear. As a result, there's a very good fit of this business into Gold One. They have the capacity to take forward a broader mining business, but they also have an ability at some point to develop the uranium. So their strategy is different than ours. Our shareholders are interested in developing a uranium business off the back of a gold business. Theirs is focused on gold, and so it's a good solution. It takes forward the gold business and at some point creates the opportunity for the uranium business to be built. But all the infrastructure, capability, and management largely stays in place once this transaction is concluded.
Okay.
The 18 megaliters of water that's decanting directly without treatment, does that also decant on your property?
Most of it, I think, yes, to a large extent. In fact, that photograph I showed you is where the bulk of it comes out.
And that's on your problem. Okay. Let's have the next one. Who is next?
Thank you, Mr. Manager. Mintel. Mr. Van der Walt.
Okay. He's very close to take on the slack. All right, go for it. Thank you.
mint tails, not tails.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Where did you get a funny name like it?
I didn't choose that. I've been asked by Mintels to do the presentation. Unfortunately,
it's only Afrikaners, Engels, and Amal will get up. So it's very of this family. Mintels.
It stands for mineral tailings.
Tailings, okay. Handwork.
Thanks a lot, Chief. I've been asked by Mintels to present. Mr. Dick van der Walt's not with the company anymore, so just standing in for Mintels. Mintels essentially started in the West Rand area in about 2006. It bought a gold operation called Mogale Gold on the West Rand, which was at that stage under judicial management, and it brought it out of jail, and as part of that process, separated underground from surface operations. For that reason, Mogale Gold doesn't own any underground operations at all, and is currently reprocessing gold tailings, or old tailings dumps, as better known. For that reason, Mintels and Mogale doesn't accept any liability because they don't have any underground operations or never had any underground operations. But having said that, formed an integral role in the funding or the formation of WEBEC, the Western Basin Environmental Corporation, the Section 21 company, and throughout the process supported the WAC proposal from 2006 and has recommended that also to the Department of Water Affairs. It's important to emphasize that Mintels does not have any ownership or shareholding within the WAC proposal. The involvement is within the WEBEC structure, or the Western Basin Environmental Corporation, which is a Section 21 company. Since its inception, Mintels has continuously assisted in the treatment of this AMD in good faith, without accepting any liability, and we'll go through some of the details just now on what Mintels has done. Now, during this process, in 2009, a directive was issued by the department in which liability was then adjudicated to for downstream users to Mintels. And for that reason, Mintels decided to approach the High Court and then also suspended the operations at that given point in time. Now, a refurbishment of an old tailing thickening process was done in 2008, and that was converted into a high-density sludge plant, which essentially neutralizes the water and then removes the metal hydroxide. And the cost of that was an approximately 20 million rand. Since March 2008, Mintels have treated in excess of 9,000 megaliters of AMD and discharged about 4,000. The balance of that was consumed in its own treatment process as grey water or partially treated water. And that came at a cost of about 40 million. So all up, Mintels have contributed approximately 60 million rand to this problem in the last 4 years. Mogale is currently still treating approximately 8 megalitres per day, but it's all for its own consumptive use as grey water in the process. It has, as I've mentioned previously, supported the WAC and the WEBEC initiatives, and specifically been involved in the long-term sustainable solution and assisted in the short-term period to get this long-term sustainable solution up and running. Mogale also received authorization in 2008 to backfill an old Westwood spit, which is situated approximately a kilometer away from the plant. The Westwood spit belongs to the Mogale City Council, and Mogale City Council previously purchased this pit to use it as a backfill site. Department of Water Affairs refused to have that done, and we have subsequently done a huge amount of work to justify why the pit had to be rehabilitated. Part of the Council of Geoscience Studies have contributed ingress to this Westford pit of approximately 16% of ingress of water. So in order to rehabilitate this pit, you can reduce the ingress of water into the basin by about 16%, between 16 and 20%. So apart from Mintels removing tailings dams, reprocessing that, and rehabilitating the pit, you will also get an additional benefit of reducing the ingress into the basin on a sustainable manner. And as I've mentioned to you, it is continuously pulling out of the pit between 8 and 10 megaliters per day. Mintails would like to have got a specific program in which they intend to increase the processing capacity of the plant within the next year, which will again consume additional acid mine drainage, which will assist in obviously alleviating the problem for downstream users. And that's our presentation.
Is this correct, Mr. Kitt, that there's a pit that lets 20% of the ingress into the Western Basin?
That's correct, Chair. That's the best bit, but we know about it.
Why aren't we doing something about it?
Well, that's why we, after they submitted new information, that's why we agreed that they can deposit in the pit, and that's exactly what they're doing now. So we first issued them a directive, and they've got a license now for one part of the pit.
What, to use the water?
No, to discharge the slimes into the pit in order to fill up the pit. That will be part of the long-term solution to cap that area so that you can stop the ingression.
But he says 18 to 20% of the water that's ingressing into the Western Basin is from that pit. Is that correct?
There are different opinions about it, but it varies from 15 to, I even heard 25% at one stage. But, I mean, his figure is more or less on the spot. But, yes, that's true.
Yeah, but then I can't understand this. What is ingressing from there, 20% of the water that goes into the basin? So if you stop it ingressing there, then 20% less goes in, number one. Number two, you then talk that you're allowing other things to be pumped into this thing that's ingressing 20%.
Chair, no. I mean, the whole idea is to seal off this area because you've got exposure at the moment. I mean, it's quite a big area, you've got the photo on the slide there. It's quite a big area, so it's exposed now to any rain event. So what you want to do is you want to seal it off, so you want to deposit solids in there so that you can cap it to ensure that you don't have any further ingression. And then by doing so, you can stop 15 to 25% of the fresh water or surface water being contaminated.
How does it ingress? It's now standing there. Is it because it sinks down?
Or
is it run in, or what does it do?
Well, it's both. I mean, if you don't have good walls around the area, then the water can flow in then surface water, and it's also direct rainfall because it's quite a big area that's exposed at the moment. It's quite big. So, I mean, even direct rainfall, it makes a major difference in the amount of water that comes into the pit.
And in your view, if you fill that with solids, then immediately that problem disappears.
That's correct, Chief. If you seal it off, I mean, you can't leave it like that, but you have to seal it off. You can cap it by means of grass or whatever.
TCTA, this must then be a priority. Instead of creating plants that are going to pump water out, stop the water going in. Surely this must be a priority of ours.
See, I think there are a number of these pits in the Western Basin. So this is one of the pits that will be filled over time. And when we spoke earlier about the long-term yield of the Western Basin, where currently there's a decant of 50, but the long-term yield of the Western Basin is only 15. That takes into account that over time these open pits will be sealed off. So if we put in infrastructure, we have to consider the long-term yield so that we don't build excess capacity which won't be utilized over the long term. So these factors are definitely taken into consideration.
Hey, it sounds to me like you're stealing from Peter to pay Paul. I don't understand it. I don't understand how your solution would want to be to create the pumps instead of stopping the water going in. Surely that must be your first solution.
See, I think perhaps Jacques can, because it's part of his operation, to fill a pit like that takes a number of years. And once this one is filled, they will move on to putting their sludge into another pit. So to fill those pits will be enormous relatively expensive unless it's part of a mining
operation.
Is this
sludge contaminated?
Can I answer that? Just to give you an idea, the pit itself will consume approximately 50 million tons to get it up to surface level. There's currently a study on to see the additional capacity to cap it, and that is anticipated to be at about another 5 to 7 million tons. So in total, you're talking about approximately 35 to 38 million tons, which will be used to displace the water and make sure the water doesn't enter into the pit itself. The quality of the tailings itself, what we've done is through the Council of Geoscience, did a hazardous waste characterization of the tailings, and that has proven to be a non-hazard material because we also do cyanide destruction prior to discharging into the pit itself.
How long is it going to take to fill it?
That is obviously dependent on the mining rate. At current mining rates, it will take at least 10 to 15 years. With the process that Mintails is currently going through to upgrade the facility, the treatment facility, that process can last within, or that pit could be refilled within the next 5 years.
What is the quality of the water that's in there now?
The quality has actually improved. The quality of the water before we started depositing into the pit was at a pH of about 2.5, pure acid mine drainage. Since we started depositing, that pH has increased to 6, and the sulfate levels have dropped about, I would say, 1,000 ppm.
What is the reason for that?
The reason for it is tailings has got a very high pH. You're talking about a pH between 10 and 11 from the gold process. And obviously, as that tailings gets into the pit, it then starts neutralizing the free acid. As you neutralize the free acid, you start converting the the iron from ferrous into ferric, and that starts precipitating out. And you also form a complex called calcium sulfate, which reduces the sulfate level as well. That's precipitate.
And that's the water that's leaking now into the basin.
Yes. There was also a study done to look at specifically what is the impact of the Vetsvet spit with regards to the rest of the basin. It was found that the Vetsvet spit is a very isolated pit compared to the rest of the basin. And to put it into perspective, it is as if you would have a glass connected with a straw onto your bathtub. So it's very, very small impact from the pit itself onto the basin in terms of quality, but in terms of volume, you don't have that hydraulic head coming through the system anymore.
How many other pits are there in the area like this?
Rick could help me, but I think it's about 10.
Is this the biggest?
Yeah.
All right, question? Any question? Morgan?
To what extent is it uranium, extraction uranium mining that is going into these pits?
The tailings operations that we're currently conducting has got very low uranium content in that. But again, what happens through the process of cyanide tailing, because of high pHs that you've got in the tails, you complex the uranium and you actually make it precipitate in a stable format. The same as what you do in removing uranium out of AMD by adding lime into it. As soon as you add the lime, you complex that precipitates the uranium. So uranium is very low. And that was all part of the hazardous waste characterization done by the Council of Geoscience, where they do three specific tests. They look at acid rain leach test, toxicity leach test, batch leach test, and then column leach test. Now, all three of those tests are operated over a three-month period at acidic conditions to look at the resolubilization of heavy metals into the solution. There was various sources of backfill material evaluated, and it was found that tailings is the best source for refilling or backfilling these pits.
Does the National Nuclear Regulator have a role to play on this site and similar sites by virtue of the fact that uranium is involved?
Mintel does have a COR and is complying with our COR.
What's the COR?
It's a certificate of registration with the National Nuclear Regulator.
Do they come and check?
Yes.
When you fill that thing in and you put sand over it, are plants going to grow there? Are people going to get warts on their faces? Are their arms going to be half falling off and things?
No. There's a specific methodology used to cap it, ensure that runoff water doesn't also accumulate within that area. And then once you've capped it, you will obviously rehabilitate the area with natural soil.
But until the 5 years' time that thing's filled, it's going to keep leaking into the basin.
It's actually until it's sealed off. And the sealing off of that at current processing, or at the increased processing rates, will be in about 18 to 24 months. So it's about 2 years before you've sealed it off. Once you've sealed off the pit from the rest of the basin, it then acts as a normal tailings dam.
Which is what?
The water is...
What is a normal tailings dam?
The water is isolated in a pool. And the water from the pool is then pumped back into the operation and reused for own purposes. So all of that water is then contained.
So you're going to fill it up, seal it, and then you'll have a pool on top of it that you use the water again.
Correct. Up to the stage where you filled it up to surface level, you then cap it, and at that stage you cap it to such an extent that the water flows away from the dump itself by ensuring that your contour lines take it into a natural flow area.
Explain to me this capping process. What is it in terms of engineering? What structure is being created? Say you cap something.
It's sloping of contour lines. Firstly, to ensure, as I say, that you don't get an accumulation of water with on top of the dam. Then there's various ways of capping it. There's impermeable layers that can be put on. There's natural ground swell that can be put on. Grazing and vegetation. So that is a fairly well-established process on creating vegetation on top of that material after you've done it. The biggest portion of that is to ensure that we don't accumulate water on top of that area to get it to run off the normal sites and into a natural area.
So the idea here is water that would normally have ingressed. Is now going to be captured and used for another productive purpose.
Well, you're going to prevent any contamination from it in the first place by ensuring that it runs off before getting into contact with any contaminated area. So it's not capturing because that would then require a dam, and that the Department of Water Affairs is going to create a... So it's not capturing now.
But what is the dam you said you're going to use the water again?
Now, that is within the pit itself. So while you're filling up, you've got the walls of the pit, and therefore you've got a dam of water on top of the tailings, and that is just part of the water that you consume the whole time. So you
pull it in, and then you close it, and then there's
correct.
The water runs off naturally.
Correct. That's
it. And the other 10 pits, are they doing the same thing, or are they just standing?
As far as I know, and maybe we can just refer this to Rand Uranium, because these pits belong to Rand Uranium, but they've gone through the process of having this authorized, and they'll follow the own process of rehabilitating these pits, but maybe Rex can assist.
Chair, so we've been through a permitting, well, engineering and permitting process to also use these pits for deposition. So it's ultimately following a similar process. And it was part of a bigger process to find long-term deposition for the products from mining. And obviously this is a solution, important solution for two reasons. It uses existing mining infrastructure and then helps to seal off one of these pits as well.
Do you also do tailings?
What are
you going to fill it with?
No, we do...
That contaminated.
Very similar material to what the Mandel is treating.
They say they treat it with cyanide, so then it's got a high pH level. So I'm trying to work out if yours going to have the same.
The process is identical in terms of gold recovery. The tailings from that would be the same. When it was used in for depth deposition, we need to go through cyanide destruction as well.
Mr. Kidd, you guys check this regularly.
Yes, I mean, we do analysis on it, but I mean, I just want to say that it sounds very obvious to use PIT as a sort of a seal-off, and I agree with that. But the reason why we're taking so long, it's because, you know, we first want to see whether what is the new impact of depositing in PIT, and specifically this one, because it's not just dumping the slimes in the PIT, because you don't know where that slimes may flow to. Because it could happen that you dump it the one day and a week after it pops up somewhere else. And that's what we want to prevent. So they first have to do proper geological investigation to ensure that we cover.
When are they doing that?
It's to ensure that you don't have.
When are they doing that?
They have to do that before they apply for a license. That's part of the license application.
Yeah, but you now say they're dumping slimes in there, it can pop up somewhere else. Who is checking whether it's popping up somewhere else?
Well, Chair, that's why when you issue a license, I mean, that's part of the conditions in the license. And it's fully described, and that's what Yaku explained. You've got that as license conditions.
So they monitor it?
They monitor themselves, and we also do that. Because, I mean, what's happening there, you can probably see downstream where the water comes out at the decant point. You can see the impact of, if there's any direct link, you'll see the impact at the discharge point. And at other boreholes, which are monitored.
Just to give you some more information on that, Mr. Chair, we've got monitoring boreholes all around the pit. We've got monitoring points within the pit, and all of these are done on a daily and weekly sample analysis. And that is compiled in one report, which is reported to the department on a monthly basis.
As you report monthly?
Yes.
And you're honest?
Yes.
What will happen if you're not honest?
All the samples are done by independent third-party accredited laboratories. So it's not done by ourselves. The sampling is taken by the laboratory itself and then done by the laboratory, and that is what is reported.
Mr. Morgan?
Before I ask my next question, I want to explain the pro. When you say you dump the backfill, that is from the dump, it's a sludge. Is that wet? Okay, so, and that means that moisture truly still permeates the ground and can then get into whatever's underneath the ground. And your argument is that this is kind of inert. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this particular sludge, because it's dolomite underneath. That's correct?
Some of the areas does contain dolomite, but not specifically in this area. What is important is what you do is the tailings, as I've mentioned, has actually improved the quality of the water within the pit because of the neutralizing ability from the tailings itself. You are correct by stating that the tailings itself is essentially inert once we've put it back into that scenario. So we treat it. Very high pH, that is then reintroduced back into the pit, and what you have is the sand or the slime settles out to the bottom and forces the water to the top. When I said that it will take between 18 and 24 months to seal off the pit, that is exactly what it means, that the tailings then forms an impermeable layer that forces the water to the top, and the water is extracted from the top and reused back into the process.
There will be some level of ingress. I mean, you will never stop it, just like the water is running in now. So the important thing is that we must be assured that this thing is not contaminated. And we're not sealing off a contaminated, a lot of stuff is going to get back into the water.
It is for that exact purpose that we've drilled boreholes, monitoring boreholes, around the pit. And then what you do is you sample those monitoring boreholes so that if you have any diffusion of the water outside of the pit area, we refer to it as the pollution plume, you will immediately pick that up. And it's those results which is reported to the department on a monthly basis, taken on daily and weekly samples.
Yaku, to what extent does the underneath that pit, does that link up with, I mean, I know that the reason done is to stop ingress in the future, but what extent does that ingress actually affect people's drinking water or borehole water or irrigation water? I mean, do you know, does it link with that, and is there any discernible change in it from these actions?
First answer is there's no link to that. We haven't seen any movement of the pollution plume within the boreholes, and we've got on all four corners of the northeast, south, and west from the borehole around the pit. So there's no interlinking or pollution plume that we can see from that pit itself, and we haven't picked up anything in the surrounding area. And there's obviously a lot of monitoring being done within that specific area. Downstream of the pit itself starts BRI decant, and the rest of that area is very well monitored.
And to what extent do you have forums where you actually communicate with affect people in the neighboring area or downstream users so that they can actually report back to you, and you can obviously tell people what you're doing?
There's a we refer to it as the Western Basin Technical Working Group meeting, which is held every 3 months, in which the mines report back to the public at this meeting. It's chaired by the Department of Water Affairs, where we report back on decant qualities, decant volumes, pit depositioning. At this meeting, we obviously also presented the findings of the study in terms of how the Bedford's pit is connected into the void, etc. So every 3 months, there's a report back.
My last point here is really, I think it's just a discussion with you. I mean, this is a significant step. There's that it's a big project. On the one hand, obviously, we want to stop the ingress, but I also respect Mr. Keith's sort of cautiousness about this as well, because, you know, it's still early days, and I would certainly hope that, I mean, I understand that Mintel's have to do their own testing. I mean, that goes without saying, but I mean, is there an independent verification that the Department of Water does? I mean, or do you, and I'm not suggesting by any means that you're altering things, but is there a way of obviously verifying the results of their tests and assessing whether, in fact, there is a plume or not?
Chair, the only way that we can do that is by regulating it. So we're doing auditing samples on a regular basis. Not on the boreholes that Jocko spoke about, but we do it on the decant point, and also, you know, on other levels. So we check it on a regular basis. So, I mean, if there's any discrepancy, we will pick it up immediately.
But excuse me, you know, I'm ignorant about this. But if water is contaminated, it's pouring out, what are you checking? I mean, that it's more contaminated, that it's differently contaminated, that it's contaminated. Got all these ions and rubbish in it. I'm trying to work out what do you check now? How would you know, with the water coming out there, how would you know that the water from these pits are actually getting into the underground?
Chair, that's just a way our chemistry works. I mean, you can easily pick it up. I mean, if I do sampling and you look at the results, the interpretation is actually fairly easy. You can pick up where the water originates from. And, I mean, there are different levels of contaminated, I agree, but, I mean, there are levels that will probably be acceptable. Like, for instance, sulfate levels. I mean, sulfate, 200 milligrams per liter is fairly high, but you can drink the water. 600 is much higher, but you can still drink the water, and it's still acceptable. But the moment you go over that, then it's not acceptable. So it's different levels of pollution.
Sounds like hocus pocus to me. Logically, it sounds like hocus pocus. Mr. Morgan?
Yeah, cool. I understand that there are downstream users, particularly farmers, who worry about the results, the water ingressing here. Do you invite members of the farming community to your meetings? And if not, will you make a commitment to engage with farmers going forward?
The Western Basin Technical Working Group meeting is totally open to the public, and yes, there's a specific, all the downstream users are invited on that, and they form part of that process.
Can you publicly announce
It's actually done by Department of Water Affairs, because they're tearing that process.
What do you do? Put it in a newspaper? Drop leaflets at people's homes? Phone them?
Chair, no, but the
or
public...
Or you just call a meeting in the Government Gazette that no one ever reads, not even the civil servants?
No, it's an open meeting and people can attend. I mean,
yeah, but we're trying to find out how you're asking people to attend. How would the Gauteng legislator know, for example, so they can go to those meetings? How will the municipality of Mogale know? So I'm trying to find out, how do people get told about it? I accept it's open, but it's different having an open meeting where the real role players are present and having a meeting between you and the mine owners.
Chair, we had it in the news. I mean, we had it as media releases at one stage. So from time to time, we invite people to this as it's open meetings. And I mean, we've got the media there quite often.
Now, Mr. Kidd, I want to see a list of the people you invite from now on. Every 3 months, you must send me that list, and you must tell me what happened at that meeting. Give me a minute of it. Because I want to see that the Gauteng legislators invited. I want to see all the municipalities that are involved. I want to see the farmers. You see, because the problem is this. If you tell me that things are going to pop up somewhere and you can check the chemicals and watch it, we're only going to be able to do that if everyone knows about me looking for the problem. And the people that have got the know-how and the knowledge to do that are people like the legislators, the big farming associations, the municipalities. The ordinary person living in a shack next to some water that's running past there, they've got no means of knowing that the sulfate's risen, that there's now whatever in it. Other people must do it for them. And the other people are government, the mining industry that's responsible, and other people that use the water. So when we have meetings like this, I really congratulate the department for having them. But we must make sure that the right people are there who are going to then become your eyes and ears. You need eyes and ears. I know you've got two, and you've got 2 ears and 2 eyes at the moment, but you need more. You need like big ones, like an elephant's got, so you can check and hear these things. Because it doesn't mean that these guys are doing something wrong. But to tell the truth, none of us know where that rubbish goes. We may all think it's going to go downstream, but it may go in another direction for some other reason. There may be a river down under that and taking it all to another place, or there might maybe an aquifer there that does, I don't know. I don't know how these water things work. But the point is that, to me, is that if we try to fix up a problem, let's get the most people involved so that the solutions we're paying for, particularly if the government's having to pay for it, the solutions that we're paying for are actually real solutions. And that this problem's not going to arise for the next generation. Okay. So what I want from now on, I want you to show us who you've invited. I want nice little invites. I want to see you've written Gauteng legislator, Gauteng government of environmental affairs, municipality of so-and-so, the farming community of so-and-so. I want to see all those people have been invited to the next meeting, okay? So we can get buy-in. And people can also say, these are the solutions, we agree with it. So if they don't, then they, of course, can make their inputs there, okay? All right.
Just to add that, the idea of the media release should continue, though, but not as an ad hoc thing, every time.
No, they can do all that so that ordinary people can see it and if they want to come. But there's specific people that have to be targeted. They must get specific invites, okay? All right, Mr. Kidd?
Chair, if I can just add to that, I mean, what I can say is that the Western District Municipality, or they are involved, and I mean, they know who the water users downstream are. So from time to time, they do the invitations. And risk
but it's much easier if you... It's your party. When I have a party, I don't invite Pete and say, Pete, will you please send invites to the other folks as well? Because Pete may not like the other folks. He may want to keep it all for himself. He wants to come have a big party, drink a lot, eat a lot. So he's not going to invite all the other folks. Pete's like that. He's not going to invite the others.
Yeah, but we're just using the different spheres of government.
Yeah, but I want you to, let's not debate this. It's not debatable. From now on, you invite the provincial government, you invite the provincial legislature, you invite the municipalities involved, you invite the farming communities at the very, not farming, but the associations if they are. Those are the kind of people we must have there, okay? Then, as Mr. Morgan says, generally you tell the public we're having a meeting. Okay? But I want to see invites to those. Don't leave it to Mokgale. Mokgale don't like the legislators. You don't know if they like them. Maybe the one is DA, one is the ANC. They don't like each other. They haven't invited each other. Who knows? Actually. Yes, Mr. Matebe. Good evening. Nice to have you here. No problem. I'm just joking.
I'm pretty impressed by what you're saying, and I'm tempted to ask Mr. Kick about the relationship between the department, the mining community, and the Because during our oversight visit last year, we were with Mr. Jason. It was evident to us that there is no coordination between the mining community, the department, and the municipality, to an extent whereby the municipality was even allocating spend to people on a property where this mining acid mining is decant into. And we were shown that area by Mr. Hitling. That lady. It was there. We engaged the municipality. And it was evident to us that the municipality, the department, and the mining community are not working together. And then we asked Mr. Kicker, the regional director, to say, let us be informed about the future. How are we moving forward solving this problem? Because we cannot allow people to be given land where there is this disaster happening. And since we haven't received the feedback from Mr. Kicker. So we don't know whether those RDP houses which were supposed to be built there have been built, or they shifted them to another place or what. So can we be advised from Mr. Kidders to what has happened to this type of thing? And also to tell us as to what is the relationship, how it does it stand now between the department, the municipality, and the mining community.
The coordination
part of it.
That's
what
now. Mr.
Keith? Chair, thanks for the honorable member, but I have to defend my department there. I mean, that's not my department's responsibility, because I know exactly what the honorable member is talking about, but that's been dealt with by the National Nuclear Regulator. People were put on places where they were not allowed to build houses. I agree with that. But I think that's been dealt with in a separate and I'm not sure we can ask Ms. Liefering to assist us there, because that one has been solved.
Yeah, but the issue of of communication, that changes from today. From today, we're going to do what I said earlier. We're going to get reports on these things. This committee is not scared of reading. Yeah, you won't find anyone scared of reading. Every 3 months, I want to hear that this thing has happened. I want to hear a report back from it a minute of that meeting. I want to see that everyone was invited and everyone was there. It's the only way to govern a country is to do it with people. Looks like they're very lovey-dovey. These ones here love those ones very much. I'm just not sure of the farming community, but the mines and the department seem to love each other now. They keep withdrawing directives, they suspend the directives. Mr. Keith, how's the relationship? Is it Keith and Makeup?
No, Chair.
Sunyala Maga?
Not with the mines. I mean, you can see we're sitting on different sides, Chair.
So, you know, it's not easy in terms of intergovernmental management, because, I mean, between us and DMR, because, I mean, it's different levels of management. And specifically what the Honourable Member spoke about is the area. And we were also very concerned during that visit. We saw that people are living where they're not supposed to live, and it was allowed by the municipality. Hence, there was a letter from the NNR, and I think the people were removed there with success. And, I mean, that happened some time ago already. But
this,
in terms
not a free-for-all.
But in terms
not a free-for-all. You don't just get involved.
Sorry, Chair, but...
By invitation.
In terms of the relation, you don't want me to go one by one with the mines. But in general, it's good, because at the moment we get good cooperation from most of the mines.
Hmm.
I repeat, most of the mines, Chair. That's all.
All right, he'll tell you after quietly. Tell him afterwards quietly who the ones or the bad ones are, so you can donor them a bit, okay? All right, so are those all the questions we had for Mintail? From now on, there'll be much closer reporting to us. We'll hear what's going on so we can be on top of things, okay? And then that lady there, you can speak to, want to hear what has happened about your houses there. Okay, that's the second one. What's the time? Yeah, you did want lunch. That's all you want. I don't know. This Parliament lunch is so horrible. Okay, now it's a lot of time still. The next one, please. Who's next? That is Central Rand Gold, Mr. Tatoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Johan de Smee from CEO of Central Rand Gold, and I suppose we're moving from the Western Basin now to the Central Basin. And let me, before I start, Ernest, just maybe give you a bit of a feel for where Central Rand Gold is situated and what mining rights and prospecting rights it has. That is a map of Johannesburg. Unfortunately, I don't have one of those fancy pointers, and but if you... If I try and position that map just above that purple colored area, that's probably city center, Standard Bank head office and the like. So we have prospecting rights from that peachy color area, that kind of sweater area, all the way across to the blue area, the top area. Ignore the green at this stage. That is really what Central Rand Gold has been able to acquire via prospecting rights. And it has a mining right in that red area where NOMR1 stands. That's where it's mining rights are, and its operation that it currently has is that little blue dot there, so a very small part still within the rights of the company. Just to kind of give a bit of background to those rights, you know, we have rights over areas such as City Deep, Crown Mines, Village Main, and in many ways these are the kind of the grandfathers and grandmothers of gold mining in South Africa. Now this is the reason why Joburg existed, of these areas and gold being discovered in those areas. And these areas were largely mined, started mining in the 1880s, and for various economic reasons, ceased basically in the 1970s. So really no mining in the Central Basin in those areas had occurred for the last 40 years. And all intents and purposes was seen as fully exploited. So many of those mining companies that exploited those over the 100 years, of course, have since disappeared. It was really when Central Rand Gold saw a window of opportunity and was able to acquire some prospecting rights over those areas I've just shown, and really looked at that and said, is there enough gold left behind by the old timers using the old technology that we could form a new mine and restart gold mining in Johannesburg? And through quite a lot of work and a lot of prospecting work, the company had the honor or the privilege to receive its first mining right at the end of 2008 over that area that I showed. And the mining right stretches around about 12 kilometers down to 900 meters below surface. Since 2008, the company has been really, I suppose, what we will define ourselves as nearly in a trial mining phase, really setting up the mine as a company. And our current development goes down to around about 200 meters below surface. That's really where our development to date has stopped, so in many ways above ETL level at this stage. And really, we've stopped it until we have more clarity around water and understanding where the water table can be stopped and will be stopped. And once we have clarity, we will then continue with our development. As has been discussed, I suppose, through the forum, is, you know, under what obligations does this mine get its mining rights? Because there's really two sides to that. One is when we applied for our mining rights, and, you know, we first put it down in 2007, well, there was a water solution already in place. You know, ERPM was pumping from 900 meters above, from below surface. So in many ways, the water, and we wouldn't get down to 900 meters for many years. So in many ways, the water problem, there was no water problem at that stage when we were applying for a mining right. In our mining right application, I think we just put some money away to assist in the operational running of the pumps. I think it was around about, it wasn't significant. I think it was around about R1 million a year that will be used to help lift or subsidize the operational costs. There was no agreement that was set, but this is also clear from the mining rights and our application that we had carried no past liability from old workings and all the rest, old void, and would really be as we carried on mining, as our mining developed, that we needed to make sure that we managed the water and we managed our liability accordingly. So really our understanding with the application was there was never any past liability that if we didn't make it, we should.
Is there any mine on your property that still has acid mine drainage water?
No, Mr. Chairman. The water is still 300 or 400 meters or 400 meters.
That's all you should say, then we won't ask you any questions. If there's no water on your land, it's fine.
But it's coming. That's
why we're gonna give you a mining levy.
Yeah, so on the mining level, which is an interesting one, let's talk about what Central Rand Gold has done, I suppose, and try to contribute. Being the only real mining company that's really underground in the Central Basin, you know, we're the one miner that really angst to try and find a solution for the Central Basin as quickly as possible so that the national resource that lies below Joburg feet can still be mined economically. So the company is part of CBEC and has been part of, and John went through that list in his slides, through various discussions at various levels of government and engagement with Water Affairs and of recent times CCTA. We've had about 6 or 7 engagements since April since CCTA has been appointed, and we concur that the discussions with CCTA have been very, very positive, very fruitful. It's just been a disappointment that it didn't happen 18 months ago, but at least we're moving forward as a company. At the end of beginning of 2010, the company kind of voluntarily put R35 million on the table to help contribute to the pump station or to a solution. In August last year, we recognized that we sat in a catch-22. There weren't any solutions being put on the table, or government hadn't put any solutions on the table, but the submersible pumps in the scenario that Yaku will go through later on seemed to be the only viable proposition was to put a submersible pump station in and then to neutralize the water. And there was enough due diligence that we had gone through with the engineering work to identify the pumps made by RIT were the most appropriate pumps to use. The pump had a capacity of 72 megaliters a day to pump, so there was actually spare capacity within the pumps to maintain the water and even the ability to dewater the basin if required. They were also the longest lead item. That was always a risk for us as a company, is that, you know, these pumps you're not going to buy at your local hardware store and just install it within a week or two. No, they are specifically tailored, made, and engineered for the Central Basin. And they have a 12 to 30 month lead time from order to delivery. And we knew that, you know, whenever the green light gets given to start this project, the pumps will always be an issue. There will always be 13 months or 12 months to delivery. So the company in August last year actually ordered the pumps and paid for the pumps, used its contribution or its proposed contribution to order those pumps. Those pumps will be delivered in, I think, August. They're being tested. I think some members of TCK are actually going across to Germany just to make sure that they're actually there and that they're not that they actually can work. And the delivery is sometime in August this year. So the pumps will be there. Once the project gets its green light, the pumps will not be impact the timing of this project. So that's basically the contribution, the capital contribution that this company has made with its limited resources. And we believe at the time it was the right decision, and we still maintain that it is the right decision. We just hope that these funds actually do get used, which I'm sure they will be. I don't think there is another alternative. So from an economic point of view and a project point from a central Randgold point of view, you know, what this water is costing us? Now, when we got our mining rights and over our mining right and prospecting right, there's about five on a JORC resource base, about 5.4 million ounces of gold under Johannesburg. That's up about 900, which was the water level at the time of the mining right. With the water rising, of course, it's, I wouldn't say it's sterilizing, because the pumps do create the ability to dewater, but it just makes it far more difficult and will take longer. Now, if we can stop the water table across the basin at around about 250 meters below surface, there'll be about 700,000 ounces of gold left behind. So a significant amount of resource base that has been, and as I said, I don't want to use the word sterilized, but has been put underwater. So it does make a very exciting project, maybe less exciting in the short term. As a result of this, the company and the clarity that, or the uncertainty around where the water will be stopped, we stopped development, as I said earlier on, and really wait for the decision from all parties to say this is where the water table will be stopped. Because once you know where the water table can be stopped, you can then plan the mine around that. At the moment, we're mining blindly, and you know, we don't want to invest in significant and expensive development underground, only to find that it gets flooded a few months later. So the company, in all intents and purposes, is nearly on a care and maintenance mode. It has, unfortunately, had to retrench 200 people that it's trained up over the last 2 years until further clarity around this water has been obtained. So that's where the company is, Mr. Chairman. Open for any questions.
So actually, it's not just the water that we can use. Actually, if we pump the water out, there's a lot of gold still there.
There's a significant amount of gold under our feet.
That's just another picture, you know. Very interesting. All right, questions? Mr. Morgan?
Thanks. The question I asked early on to Randy Uranium, the same question I'd like to ask you. You're investing a lot of money, and what do you need the Department of Water and TCTA to be doing that they are currently not doing or are dragging their feet on? If you were to, you know, we can go to the department and say, no, I'm going to do this.
I think critically we need to understand the solution that's going to be proposed in the Central Basin, and also the project timeline when it will be implemented. So that we have a clear understanding of at what level the water table stops. I think really the solution and the timing around it, so we have a clear understanding of the company where the water table will be stopped. I think that's really the two things that we really need from TCTA at this stage.
Have we got a position on particularly stopping it somewhere, or are we going to pump all of it?
Ted, that's quite an interesting question, because we've got an ECL level in the Central Basin. And
that's what I understand. We're going to keep it below that.
Yeah. Now
these guys are talking something else.
Exactly. Now what the mines are saying, or CRG is saying, is that look, we're interested to go below that. So the discussions that we had with CRG is to say, okay, you've now ordered pumps that can keep can pump from 400 meters. Now these pumps are technically designed to function at a certain level. So what we have to decide is are we going to use those pumps or not? And what CRG wants to know from us is that if we install the pumps as they want it at a level of 400 meters below, then they have to pay for the incremental pumping cost. Now, they want to know from us what is the cost that we're going to charge them for pumping from a deeper level. And this is part of the due diligence studies that we're currently doing, and we hope to be able to give them an answer, let's say, towards the middle of July. But it's, in essence, that is the partnership that's going to be there. They are prepared to give the pumps at their cost. We will pay for the installation, but they will have to contribute to the operating cost for going down
deeper. This situation is very different. You see, the other ones, we tried to avoid the environmental hazards. This is economics.
Mm.
Something completely different. We shouldn't mix up the two. They may have similar solutions.
Yeah.
But the way that you get to it may be different. Because clearly, I mean, if any gold mine wants to make, we encourage it. If they've got the mining rights, that's great. It's all fine. The problem is the taxpayer can't pay for it. I mean, the taxpayer can't pay for someone to make profit. That'll be completely and utterly unconscionable. So I think that we must just deal with these issues separately. The other day I asked the question, is there gold still under there? And the answer wasn't. Well, the answer is now given to me. At certain levels, they can start mining. And looks like they can mine quite lucrative. That puts a completely different perspective on that part of the problem in the central area. It also takes away that solution of pumping water from the western basin to the central. You wouldn't want to do that. Create further problems. Okay, now so just think of it separately,
yeah.
Okay? It's two separate things then. Mr. Tessie?
Yeah, I'm sure all of us have observed that every presentation starts with a confession that we're not level for the map. I'm just trying to think aloud as a layperson in this business of mining, that mining is not a starter shop. It's something that has a contribution in the economic growth of the country. Don't we have some archives somewhere that so-and-so once owned a certain mine? And using common sense at other businesses, when you close a business, there's a public announcement to say auction, closing down, sale, whatever, you know, in service or whatever. So with the mining business, it's like someone wakes up one morning and goes back to Europe saying, I'll close shop.
I think, Mr. Tsetse, I'll call you when you talk.
Sorry.
Mr. Tsetse, you see, the thing is simple. All their lawyers spoke to them before they came and said, when you're there, just don't accept any liability whatsoever. And you reserve all your rights. That's why Mr. Munro started with, I reserve all my rights. Because their lawyers have told them to do all this. But there is a bigger problem. And, you know, I think we must, and I get a lot of notes here from people saying, you mustn't say that's not retrospective. You see, the issue is very simple. When it comes to criminal matters, and you want to make things retrospective, clearly the Constitution will strike it down. When it comes to civil matters, many of our laws have civil retrospective because that's what environment's all about. If an environmental problem started somewhere, you deal with it. So, in law. But the law must give you that duty and responsibility. So, if you want to be responsible for the mining, then you'll at very least have to go and start looking at the 56 Act and what liabilities were created in the 50s. We can go back to 11 as well, but I would suggest very least 56. You'll have to go and look and analyze that act and see what are the legal liabilities that were created in law in different areas, but in this case, water in mines. Then you have to go and look at the Fani Bwota Accord of 1975. Because that accord, I've never seen something like this in my life before. I've never heard of something like this. This is a government that is very, very close to the mining industry. They're big mates. So what they do, they sit down, they sign an accord. And government basically takes on the responsibility of all the mines. What this accord says, one clause after the other, it says, if mines were at a duty from 56 onwards, and those mines have been abandoned, we, the state, take over the responsibility. Mines that were created between 56 and this accord, if you kept it to a state we were happy with, we take on the responsibility of the state. So if you read through the accord, what it has done, it has legally taken on responsibilities which the mining industry would have had during that period. So if you want to know who's liable, go back to the state. They are liable because this Mr. Bwota signed on behalf of the government, signed all its rights away, and took on all the responsibilities of the mine. Of course, Mr. Kidd, I hope you're following up some of these clauses here, because they say we can take over the ownership of those mines. It says it here. I hope you guys did that. It took over the ownership where we paid for the mine and for the water. I hope we've done that. If you haven't, you must please report back to this committee why you haven't done it. I see here there's one thing. They signed away a lot of their rights as well, but it looks like this government, or not this government, the previous one, they gave took on all the duties and the advantage they had out of this document, they may not take it. Then between 75 and now, the liability that anyone will have will flow from any legislation we sign as government. So the new Environmental Act, NEMA and those acts, will clearly create responsibilities. And most of those acts do work retrospectively, but they'll have to work against the background I've given you. So the liability will go against this background. In some instances where those mines were abandoned, the state has taken over the responsibility. In others where there was mining, clearly, the 56 Act, at the very least, will guide you and tell you what the liabilities were. So that would be your instance there. So, you know, far be it from what their lawyers have advised them. There is clearly legal liability. There is clearly legal liability. Whether those people are dead or the mines are dead, there's liability. In some instances it will be mines, and other instances it will be the state. The bigger issue that we have to ask ourselves is not the legal responsibility. The legal responsibility exists. Though some of it may, of course, have passed away by extinction, but that's another issue. But the issue is really the factual issues. How will you factually deal with these issues? Because if it's true that factually it is so that the mines are linked at the bottom, you at the top you'll see individual people making a lot of money. But at the bottom, if they're linked and the water is flowing from one or the other, then factually, as Mr. Morgan has said earlier, of course, there will be some level of liability, but it will be difficult to work out what that level is. Particularly, I think Grootvlei is very clever. They sent us a letter to say they're at the bottom of the incline. So why are they telling you that? They're telling you that because they're saying all the water that flowed from everywhere else has come to us. That's why they're trying to say to you legally, because their lawyers are telling them to do those things. So I think that is the issue that we need to deal with. Are we going to get stuck in the factual debates and deal with those factual issues, not with, as far as I'm concerned, the legalities. Because if there's been a legal duty, there's a legal duty. You'll just go back and trace who the owner is, and you'll do those. So I think that is where the issue is, and whether it's worth our while trying to fight those battles. Because is it worth trying to factually go and prove that Rand Uranium, who's got two or three other mines linked to it, and the water is bubbling up there, for whatever natural reason it bubbles up at that spot where they are, to what extent will we be able to go and prove their part of their liability? And that is why some of them keep pumping, not out of the goodness of their heart, because their lawyers told them, keep taking reasonable steps. Reasonable steps is 12 megaliters, although 30 is flowing out. They will argue that that's reasonable steps. So I think those are the facts of the legal issue. So if anyone here thinks that we have said, this committee has not, we have expressed ourselves not at all on the legalities of this issue. What we have done is to say we can see some of the difficulties that exist, that the department has raised, and we understand those difficulties, and whether it's worth our while to then try and fight legal battles where the only people that get rich are the lawyers, or whether we rather try and draw these people in as partners in trying to solve the solution. Part of that partnership is what I've raised earlier. To what extent is this mining industry and other industries are going to be able to take this liability off our hands by actually using that water? That is part of it. They come up with a solution like that, then of course all this cost, only the short-term costs are needed. The longer-term cost will carry itself through them then spending the money and so on. And I think that's really the debate. So I tell you, all the things you read in their documents is just what their lawyers have told them to put there. We mustn't feel too serious about that. But then the second part thing I wanted to say was the approach of this committee. This committee has said, whatever that legal liability may or may not be, and whether we can factually actually go and prove it in a court of law, whether we want to do those things, let's leave that for some time in the future. In the meantime, this department is responsible to get clean water for this country, and the Department of Environment is there to see that there's no environmental, and they must take steps to do so. And whatever money they spend, if they want to go and sue someone later to
to recover that money because they did what someone else had to do, let them do it then. But let's first try and find the solution. So I again wanted to say I've used this opportunity. I've been waiting for someone to ask this question. I've waited for this opportunity exactly to say to people all these letters I'm getting about, you can't say that there's no retrospectivity. We've not said it. We've not said it. We've just said there's only retrospectivity to the extent that the law at any given time has created such a liability. And if you want to prove it, well, you're going to have to prove a very difficult factual situation, which is not easy to prove. We can see all those problems. That is all that this committee has said. We've not expressed ourselves one way or the other, except to the extent that I've said, don't put the legal issues first, put the clean water first. Get the water clean, and then you deal with the legal issues. And I think that's the message we sent out as a committee to it. So if anyone has misunderstood that, I don't explain myself very well, I know that, but if you want to know further detail, please ask one of the members, they'll explain it to you, okay? All right, we got there. Where are there any questions? There's other questions? Dr. Fong, did you have your hand up? No? No, I missed it? Okay. Is that it? Mr. Morgan?
What is the, and I forget, I might have missed it. Have you actually started any operations at all with regards to mining, or are you processing on?
Yeah, we're processing. Thank you, Chair. We basically 200 meters down underground, and we're doing a bit of processing underground at 200 meters. We're doing a bit of stoping, so we are taking some of the dirt out that we can, and that comes to an end. We must throw in the next 2 or 3 months as underground stoping, and at that level deeper, because there's not that much mining left there. It really is much deeper. That's where the economics come into play.
And what potentially? I mean, if you can get the water to that level that you would like it, below the ECL, I guess the economically optimal level for you, and it's really just putting my interest here, what could you potentially employ at that mine?
We've had about 240 people currently employed, which is now put on. So for 240, we must probably go up to about 400 people. Will be a run-of-the-mill kind of operation.
You said at present there's no water in any of your mines. The water you're then pumping off from the rest of the basin.
Correct.
Are there places?
There's no pumping at the moment.
No, but when you use your pumps and the thing starts working, which will happen in a few months' time, from that moment onwards, then you're saying that more your present mines are going to be able to then be mined where there's no water, or is it other mines that where the water is?
Now, prison mine, and across the whole central basin, we can mine to that level of where the water table is. So we can mine across the mine.
Oh, I see. So there's no water, but you can only go to that level, because from that moment onwards, you've got the water problem.
Okay.
All right. I understand that. Mr. Matebe?
Is there no local company that produces those type of pipes that are all coming from
the pumps? A full feasibility had been done, and engineering work had been done, because these are submersible pumps, so they're really specifically engineered for the central basin. And a whole tender process went out, and RITS, who are stationed in South Africa, but they're factories in Germany, were seen as the kind of the masters, the Rolls-Royce pumps, so they were selected for them. But a whole due diligence process went on that process. Sorry?
My question is very straightforward. Is there no local company that can produce that pipe?
No.
No.
I'll give you a simple answer. No. Not pipes.
Pump.
No.
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 Morgan? Sir, what do you think about the one possible idea of taking water from the Western Basin and pumping it into your basin, and then pumping it's out
the gate.
I mean, obviously for treatment purposes. How does that fit with you?
It all depends on the capacity of what
you can lift. The balloon.
It all depends on the capacity of what you can lift from the central basin. I mean, you don't want the central basin to rise because of the western basin. So if you can have created equilibrium, principle, then, you know, it's actually a neutral impact. From a commercial point of view, the long-term solution might be a better play there. From our perspective, where we are at the moment, where the water table is, I would not be too in favor with it because it's just, you know, the water is really close, will be close to ECR when we stop. But it's all going to be about lifting. How much water can you lift? And if you can create that equilibrium, well, then you're actually in a neutral position, aren't you? Yeah, absolutely. And we've been open to that discussion for a while.
Yeah, it's a bad idea. Only 15 megalitres they're going to have to wipe pump it somewhere else. Put in a machine, get it. Legally, let me just find out legally, Mr. Keir. We want to talk legal liability. What is the legal standard in law by which water must be treated? Is it just neutralization? Is that what the law states?
No, Chair. In the past, we had the general standard, which was a standard that was applicable from Messina right down to Cape Town. But now we've got in-stream water quality, it's the in-stream water quality approach. So it's more you look at the receiving water, you look at a specific river, and then you determine, you know, the reserve first, and then you look at the in-stream users from that specific stream. And then from there, you go back and allocate specific license allocations or license conditions to the specific users.
No. But you must, no, you're misunderstanding. If we want to keep hold these people in law liable for something, and we said you are liable to pump water from your mine, what is the legal standard by which we want them to treat that water? So we all say it's illegal if they just pump it just like that into the river. Then there's neutralization, there's desalinization. It looks to me in practice what we've allowed over many, many decades is to neutralize the water. These guys that are pumping it now neutralized may pump it back into rivers. What is the legal standard that they should be treating it by?
Chair, it depends on the receiving water. In the past, we allowed this. I mean, it's the same where you had, like, for instance, wastewater treatment plants. And I don't want to jump it now, but, I mean, wastewater treatment plants, it depends on technology. So in the past, we allowed, for instance, high phosphates to be discharged because technology was not available. Now, when you build a new wastewater treatment plant, like sewage plant, you have to comply to, say, 1 milligram per liter phosphate or even less than that. And it's exactly the same with mines. If we have a new mining company coming now, and they want to apply for a license, they want to discharge, we restrict them to the best standard that we have for that specific river.
Do you put it in their license?
We put that.
Or is not in the law?
No, you put that in the license as a standard.
And they must treat the water to X.
They must treat the water to a specific standard. But
so before you did these licenses where you do this now, what will we then say is their legal liability? You have brought criminal charges against Grootvlei for pumping water directly into and not treating it. What are we going to rely on? Is it in their license that they should have treated the water to X?
Chair, the license specifies the exact conditions that they have to comply with.
Then it's simple.
And in the past,
when does those licenses start?
In 1998 with the new water.
So it's mines after 98 that would have the water standard attached to the license. Before 98, what would the standard have been? So you wanted to hold them legally liable, what's the standard be?
The standard was, I mean, what I said is just we try to apply the general standard, but then they can apply for an exemption. And in quite a lot of cases, industries, mining companies, wastewater treatment plants, we allow an exemption. So we issued permits, because before 1998 it was permits, and in the permit condition, you know, most of the time it was relaxed because of technology that wasn't available or because of old mining houses that didn't have the capacity to treat the water to a specific
standard. So before 1998 you'll have to go and look at permits, number one,
correct.
And second you'll have to look at the practice of actually not applying what's in the permit.
Correct.
Okay, that makes it a bit clearer to me at least. In terms of which law did you give the permits before 1998?
It was the 1956 Water
Act. The Water Act.
The Water Act, yes.
So one can there see what the law says about the permits.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, of course, and there were regulations as well.
I just want to say one thing. The other thing I forgot, of course, about the legal situation, the other thing that complicates stuff is a certain court case that took place. How about your people? Chief Pule Shadrach, the 7th Bareka versus GenCorp. That was a case where the courts in Transvaal held that you can't hold people that have given up their mining earlier liable for what happened after, before 1999. So that's a further complication. Of course, after 1999, we passed NEMA and so on and create certain obligations. So that judgment would be then done away with to the extent that the law has been changed. But the fact of the matter is, for a period after that court case, it was very clear that legally, before 1999, you could not hold those mines liable. That was the other complication legally that we faced. It still doesn't take away from any of it, because those mines that were operating at that time, this doesn't apply to them. Mines that have been abandoned before 1999. Okay. And in any case, Fani Buerta's accord messes up things in any case quite dramatically, as only that government could do. When they mess up well. Okay. Any other questions to this gentleman? All right, so ATC, no, not ATC. What's that funny name of you there? TCTA. Again, it's only a party that can give someone a name like that. TCTA. Yeah. This is incredible, actually. You know, what worries me is that this report that we want in August, you guys are going to have to look somewhat towards the pit story. And this issue is very interesting to me. The fact that they already have these pumps that are going to be available much quicker than it would have been waiting for them for a whole year. And that that means that we can look much quicker at the kind of solutions. I mean, this thing can pump 70 megaliters a day. That'll be quite substantial. So I hope that these issues are all part of the August report back.
Yes. We very much well aware of what is available. It is in fact part of the study material that we're doing the due diligence on. And for us, the critical point with CRG is that if we go deeper than the ECL level, then we need to have a binding commitment that they will feed the bill for the additional pump required.
That's fine. You can deal with that with them. As we said as a committee, we will look very funny at you and the department if you make those state responsibilities.
No, I'm not saying you are. I'm saying, listen to me, my friend.
I'm saying if you were to do it, you were to do it, we will come down on you like a ton of bricks. You won't see the day of light. You'll have to go and look for a new job at one of these mines where they're making these huge profits. Have you got me?
I've got you.
Where there is possibilities of further mining happening, clearly there we have to work the thing differently. The government and everyone cannot take on those responsibilities. We're now talking about Fani Accord taking on responsibility for abandoned mines, mines being linked up and those type of things. But when it comes to, like Grootsvlei has got the same problem, taking the water to certain levels so that they can mine, then that is a different scenario we're talking about. Again, that doesn't mean you don't do it until they've solved the issue. You just let us know that they don't want to play ball. That's all you let us know.
There's perhaps just one risk that we've also discussed with CRG is that if we now install the pumps at a level of 400, then they disappear from the face of the earth, then we sit with the risk of having to pump and incur the cost at the level below the environmental critical level.
All those guys with big yachts and so on, you get your lawyers to tie their lawyers down. That's all you do. If they're going to leave you with a responsibility, then you had bad lawyers.
Yeah.
Get good lawyers to make sure that they do not leave you with that responsibility. So when they disappear with their yachts to the Mediterranean, we've still got their assets and things.
Yeah.
Make sure. You know, in government, there's a thing where you actually, when you do certain things, you let the people sign their pensions over to you. So that you make sure that if government has got
a claim against you that you can go against the pension. This is what you must do with these chaps. I know they take most of the money out of the country and hide in any case somewhere, so it's difficult. But make sure your lawyers are better than their lawyers, okay? But I'm only joking now. I'm saying this half-heartedly because the things we're now discussing are not meant for you. They meant for you guys to sit down with the mining industry and sort those things out. I can't see. There's no way that any mining company will ever tell you they expect government or the, someone else to pay to pump the water so they can make a profit. They will never say it to you. Because legally and morally it's unconscionable. So they will never say it. Not even their lawyers will, and their lawyers are sharks, but not even their lawyers will tell them to do that. All right, lunch. We'll get back. What time is it now?
5 to 1.
Hoppas, can we get back at Hoppas 1 so we can get quicker? We've only got 2 more inputs in the Chamber of Mines so we can let people that have to take planes get early planes, okay? So let's be back Hoppas 1. Thank you.